We are recording live.
All right. Good morning. Welcome to the virtual board meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, San Francisco Bay Region. I'm Jim McGrath. I'm chair of the San Francisco Bay Water Board. And we'll call the roll for the other board members in just 1 minute. But first, I want to note that today's board meeting is being conducted in accordance with the COVID-19 emergency order to comply with public gathering limitations. And perhaps we will all live to see the end of this. As authorized by the governor's executive orders, there's no physical meeting room. People who only want to watch or listen to the meeting, board's customary webcast is available. In addition, we are receiving public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room. If you've not already received a link, you can visit our website and sign up. Guy, would you please share the website address? I'm going to give everybody a minute to note that. Public comment is very important to us, so we want to make sure that you all understand that. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. Our board clerk, Guy, will then unmute you. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute. For all speakers, we ask that you state your name when you're called upon. We appreciate your patience and understanding during this extraordinary time. We'll now call the roll. Guy?
Board Member Gunther?
Here.
Board Member Hacker?
Can you hear me? I'm here.
Yes, we can. Great.
Great.
Board Member Kissinger?
Here.
Vice Chair Betty?
Here.
And Chair McGrath?
Here. Michael Montgomery, our executive officer, has informed me that we have new staff members to introduce. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Chair. We have two new staff to introduce from our Toxics Division. Laurent Millier were introduced the first scientific aide, and then Elizabeth Wells will introduce another staff that's been hired. So, Laurent?
Yes, good morning, Board Chair McGrath and board members. My name is Laurent Millier. I'm a senior engineering geologist of the North Bay section at the Toxic Cleanup Division. Please join me to welcome Ellen Mills to the Water Board. We are glad to have her join our team as a scientific aide. She has previously worked in our office, actually, as an AmeriCorps Watershed Stewards Program member and is excited to be back. She is currently pursuing a master's degree in environmental engineering at UC Berkeley. She has a Bachelor of Science in Earth Science from UC Santa Cruz and has worked as a geotechnical laboratory technician for Cleary Consultants Incorporated. In her free time, Ellen enjoys hiking, dancing, painting, and cooking.
Welcome.
Ellen?
Good morning. I'm excited to be applying what I'm learning in school to the protection of public health and the environment. Thanks.
Welcome.
Ellen, welcome. Tell us a little bit about painting.
Well, it's something that I started because of COVID-19, and it's kind of a new hobby.
That's a very healthy response to the pandemic. Some of us have picked up other habits that aren't nearly as as productive.
Absolutely.
It's a fabulous art. I envy you. Thank
you. Next up, Elizabeth Wells. Wiz?
Good morning, Chair McGrath and board members. I'm Elizabeth Wells with this. I'm a senior water resource control engineer in the Toxic Cleanup Division, and I'm very excited to introduce our new water resource control engineer, Sherry Gamboa, who joined our Central Bay team in this division. Today is day 7, and Sherry recently finished her Bachelor of Science degree in chemical engineering at UC Davis, and to help put herself through college, Sherry worked a variety of jobs, including chemistry tutor, laboratory stocker, quality control technician, restaurant server, and a nightclub drink seller for the under 21 crowd. She also worked as a muscle prevention intern and water resource intern for the Solano County Water Agency. And it was this work involving interaction with bone owners and water quality sample collection that piqued her interest in water quality and environmental work. So Sherry is excited to join our team, and I'm so thrilled to have her be part of our team as well. Sherry?
Hello, I am Sherry Gamboa. I'm very excited to be working at the Water Board. In my spare time, I enjoy spending time with my dogs, hiking, and playing sports with the family.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. Welcome aboard.
Welcome in. That brings us to the public forum. Guy, let us know who's up.
Great. We have three people. I'm going to promote Bob Johnson first. So, Bob, you should be able to unmute and share your video.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Yep.
I don't see my picture at this end, but that's okay. My remarks concern water quality in Point Reyes National Seashore. I sent a one pager to Guy last night, but I missed the 5 o'clock deadline. But he told me if I got it to him before 8 a.m., it might make it into the packet. So you may or may not have a one pager from me. The seashore has permitted dairy and beef ranches since its founding in 1962. They've always been assumed to be part of the park. They were not in the original legislation, in spite of the myth that ranchers have promoted. These ranches have polluted our state waters consistently without adequate oversight or remediation by the park. Published studies for the last 30 years or more show high rates of exceedances for coliform, which is measured in several different ways, coliform bacteria, nitrogen, sediment, and other typical ranch pollutants. I remind you, your order, the state order, the state statute on confined animal facilities, and your order concerning dairies, confined animal facilities, both state no pollution shall leave the premises. The park has asserted that additional BMPs, best management practices, will solve the problem. That's what they said in their environmental impact statement on their proposed plan to extend the ranch leases to 20 years. However, at least two recent published studies show that BMPs made water quality slightly better, but you still have a majority of samples exceed one or two or three or four of the pollution types. So it's doubtful BMPs are going to solve the problem. You commented to the park in 2019 on the draft EIS that additional actions are needed to resolve the water quality problems. The park in the plan intends to let ranchers add small livestock, doesn't cut back on the dairy cows, but it allows them to add small livestock. And in your the board's comments to the park in 2019, you found that this will, unquote, lead to new exceedances and the extra discharges cannot be easily remediated. That's in the letter from Janet O'Hara. I conclude the ranches are in violation of the state water quality standards. Nevertheless, the park intends to increase livestock, which are the cause of most of the pollution types. So I don't know exactly the correct legal mechanism here, but in this existing process the park is in, they're headed towards a record of decision on their preferred project, which is to allow the ranchers to continue for 20 more years or more. Please urge the park to not extend the leases for 20 years, to keep the ranchers on one-year lease extensions. That's the only way I think we can keep pressure on the ranches to improve their practices. Thank you. I'll take questions if I'm allowed to.
Mr. Johnson, one of the difficulties that we have with our process is making sure that there's due process. None of the affected other parties are here. This is not noticed. So we don't generally we don't have a discussion.
I understand that.
Michael, what's the next step in terms of you informing the board and all the interested parties of what your response would be to these questions and involvement in the National Park Service?
So I did not have a whole lot of time to prep on this issue, so I'm going to hand it over to Jan O'Hare and Javier Fernandez to maybe share a little information on at least what the next steps are.
Thank you.
Jan O'Hare wasn't able to join yet, so I will. We did send letters on the EIS. We are looking at. So one of the things is that our grazing waiver and our regulation of calves has thus far only been in the Tomales Bay watershed, and not the whole park. So one of the plans is to expand those permits to apply to the entire park. And we have seen in areas where that permit, like in Olema, the Olema Creek watershed, there has been improvement on park lands in terms of pathogens. And so we do see improvement, and we'll continue to work with the park on that. The next step is for them to finalize the EIS. Then we would need to expand our coverage into areas that is not covered now. The other aspect is there's also going to be a related or potentially a 401 in watershed division, Keith Licton's division, covering maintenance activities on parklands as well.
That would be good. I saw the 401 on the Drake's Estero cleanup. So that's a good idea.
Great. Thank you, Javier. Do we have another speaker, Guy, on this matter?
We do, and I promoted her. It's Catherine Portman. She should be able to unmute and share her video now.
Good morning, board. Thanks for hearing the public. My name is Catherine Portman. I'm an advocate for wildlife and public lands. I'm really heartbroken over the severe water quality degradation at Point Reyes National Seashore, our treasured public land. The waste of thousands of cows over three decades have polluted streams and lagoons with E. coli, nitrogen, and sediment. There's gross evidence of eutrophication of wetlands. Several water quality studies show exceedances of fecal coliform standards in creeks. Data demonstrates that best management practices are ineffective. How has the San Francisco Water Quality Board abdicated its enforcement authority and allowed corporate concentrated cow feedlots to despoil the waters of Point Reyes National Seashore to the equivalent of a sewer cesspool that can no longer support sensitive species such as red-legged frogs, steelhead, and salmonids? As a taxpaying citizen, I depend on the Water Quality Board to do its job and enforce the regulations to ensure water quality that is healthy to support our natural resources. Please urge the National Park Service to not allow an increase of livestock proposed in the management plan, which would result in the discharges you said in the draft environmental impact study could not be easily remediated. Thanks for all your work.
Hi, does that complete the testimony? I see you. You were just a second. Does that complete the testimony?
We have one more. Yeah. We have one. Oh, sorry. My apologies. We have one more public speaker, but it's not the same topic.
It's not. Here we go.
I just wanted to clarify that when we have speakers at public forum, there can be a discussion. What the board can't do is take action. So to the extent that, you know, staff can share information or the board wants to give direction, it may do so on public forum matters. It's only that the board can't take action.
I guess I'm a little nervous about taking action being going too far into the giving direction. Michael, I think probably the most appropriate thing to do is cover this in your executive officer's report either next month if there's some time urgency or the following month, and make sure that the National Park Service is noticed. If I err by bending over backwards to make sure all interested parties are notified, I'm okay with that.
Sure, we can circle back. Thank you.
Alexis, you have your hand raised. Go ahead.
My apologies for joining the video portion a bit late. I just had a question when we may take this up through Mike's executive officer report. Just two questions. One, the nature of how the Park Service is working with landowners to minimize the impacts of grazing. And secondly, whether the Park Service and landowners have an understanding about number of cows per acre. I think density is an incredibly important factor in how we go about this. And we want to be supportive of agriculture. We want to be supportive of parklands and the like. And so I'm just curious to have a little bit more information at the right time. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there, density is managed by the Park Service, and what in part has sort of stemmed the concerns here is that the Park Service has proposed a change in that. And we can certainly explain that for the benefit of the board. It is an issue that we've been tracking. And as you all know, you know, we went out and visited. We made a pretty significant investment in West Marin on, you know, grazing and calf related concerns, especially given the sensitivity of the streams out there. We'll cover that information when we circle back. Thank you.
Jane, I see your hand. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jim. I'll just add to Alexis's input, and also ask that we there's so much good work and science being done right now around regenerative agriculture, which the grazing animals is very much part of that dynamic, that I hope that we'll, you know, take a look at some of that, the latest work coming out on those topics out of great places like UC Davis and Berkeley and others. But that should be part of the conversation as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. And Michael, I want to make sure that there's a careful distinction between grazing and grazing density in confined animal facilities. So when you come back to us.
Okay, great. Our staff is very up on this issue, so shouldn't be too difficult.
All right, I'm not surprised. Guy, we have one more public speaker.
Yep. And Kelly has been promoted. So Kelly, when you're available, you can unmute and share your video.
Okay, am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Okay, great. Going back to the to September of 2019 for some of the new board members, I came to the board and talked about what had happened, a precedent, action that was taken in the north in Mendocino County on the Eel River. Their major river is Eel River. They found vineyards had been planted. And watercourse tributaries had been dammed, and water of the state had been diverted. And the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board took action, and they levied fines that ranged up, that amounted to millions. I mean, millions of dollars. And they put out a press release to trumpet their vigorous enforcement of environmental and protection of environmental laws and protection of the waters of the state. I brought that to the board at that time and pointed to Alameda County. You know, the major tributary of Alameda County, the major river here is called Alameda Creek. And an unnamed tributary was dammed. An arroyo was destroyed and filled and graded. New roads were built and paved, and drainage culverts were built into the resulting lake. 18 acre feet of waters of the state were diverted and stored behind the unpermitted dam, actually. A large center for entertainment facility was constructed with permits as an agricultural barn, but designed as an event center. With an occupancy of 400 persons, exceeding the septic limit. Septic limit was 100 persons, according to the Environmental Health Department of the county. The local agency did very little or nothing, especially as they watched the grading, the dam construction, the large events, the destruction of the arroyo, the paving of the road. What did the board do? Board asked the staff to come back with an executive officer's report. That was 18 months ago. That action, forget about action. Updates are needed. Let's come back after 18 months to the board with the executive officer's report. And there are further, there's a lot of things that can be learned here about administrative cooperation, coordination among agencies. And let's start with circling back to this board and reporting on the status. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Abreu. I've been here. I remember your original testimony. So, Michael, I think it is time for an update because, and for Mr. Abreu, because there are particular administrative and procedural aspects to proceedings in the case of violations or alleged violations. Some of these things are a little more difficult to arrange and talk about, but we'll see what we can do. All right, Guy, are we done with public comment?
That is it for public comment, although I do want to say we do have someone who wishes to speak during the EO report, so just to keep that in mind.
Let me know when that is.
Yeah, that would be now, Guy, because...
Now? Okay, so I will promote. I will promote now.
EO doesn't have a public.
So I've promoted Josh, and... Josh, you are able to unmute and share your video.
Hi, this is Josh Quigley with Save the Bay. I'm just wanted to comment on the Caltrans compliance with the cease and desist order regarding pollution prevention in San Francisco Bay. As the executive officer's report will state, and we agree that Caltrans' recent submission dedication of funds to this work is showing some great progress. But the big deficiencies that the board staff have identified need to be addressed by Caltrans now, not next year. Caltrans has now been operating under the cease and desist order for 2 years, and that followed a period of 4 years of operating in violation of its obligations under this board's permit authority and Clean Water Act. And throughout that time, San Francisco Bay has continued to be impaired by illegal trash pollution from Caltrans roads. The most recent December annual work plan does show improvement from its previous stance. However, the staff report acknowledges there remain many substantive and significant deficiencies that will leave Caltrans out of compliance with the CDO. Last year, when the board issued a conditional acceptance of Caltrans' 2019 work plan, you stated that additional significant work would be required to achieve trash control benchmarks beyond 2020. Despite that warning and the significant ongoing feedback that the Water Board staff have provided throughout this past year, the plan that Caltrans submitted does not fully comply with the board's order. While we appreciate the staff have once again offered clear direction to Caltrans about the areas that need to be improved, which echoed many of the concerns that we addressed to staff in writing earlier this year, We don't agree that Caltrans should be allowed another 10 months to correct those deficiencies. Given Caltrans's extensive history of failing to comply with this board's directives and the board's clear guidance for the most recent work plan, the board should require corrective action by Caltrans sooner, by June 30th, 2021 at the latest. San Francisco Bay continues to be impaired by illegal trash pollution from Caltrans roads as the agency has failed to comply with its permit for more than 6 years. Staff has determined that the agency's current submission keeps it on a path towards noncompliance. The health of the Bay and the credibility of the regional board's compliance regime depend on swift corrective action. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I believe we'll take this up in the executive orders, director's executive officer's report, excuse me. That brings us to item three, the minutes of the February 10th, 2021 board meeting. You've been furnished a copy. If there are any suggestions for changes, I'd like to hear them. If not, I'd like to hear a motion for approval.
I move to approve.
One minute, Chair. We do have one edit that we had identified. And there was a clarification on, this is on, excuse me, this is on page two, under the board member report out. We want to clarify board members' comment that this is regarding the Climate Action Subcommittee. We want to clarify that her comment was addressing the need to prioritize our climate-related activities based on risk and need. It was written a little bit less specifically, and in fact, going back and reviewing the event, that's a proper clarification. So that's one edit. That's all we have.
And you've incorporated that into your recommendation to
us. We will, yes.
And Bill, was that you that made the motion to approve?
It was me, and I will amend my motion to include the correction made by Mike.
Thank you, Andy. And is there a second?
I'll second.
Second by Board Member Kissinger. Remind me, do we do this with a hand vote or a roll call?
Hand vote, I think.
All right. All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
All board members concurred. That brings us to the chair, board member, and executive officer reports. Tam is here, I believe, or she was, and I'd love to hear from her. Tam, go ahead.
I am here. I am happy to still be here. Thank you very much for allowing me to join you this morning. As always, it's a pleasure to see all of you and to hear about the new additions to the regional board. You've got some excellent staff coming in. Just quickly, two things that I wanted you to be aware of. I think you've already mentioned, and we all know, your great interest and leadership on climate change issues. So at the State Water Board meeting next week on Tuesday, we will be having an informational item, hearing from staff on climate change activities that we've undertaken, the totality of the state and regional water boards. As you know, in 2017, I believe it was, we adopted a climate change resolution. And since then, you know, we've been each year getting a report from staff on the activities that have been undertaken as directed under that resolution. And this year we will again get that report, but we will also discuss priorities for the next year based on the State Water Board strategic plan, as well as the focus this year on racial equity, and obviously on the governor's water resilient portfolio as well. And in addition, board member Firestone and I are paired on this issue. And I want to mention this because I know metrics is also an item of interest, especially to the chair. Board member Firestone and I in particular would like to have a discussion on not just, you know, what we've done on climate change, what our priorities will be for the next year, but also identifying a few key areas where, if possible, we could establish some performance metrics that could be tracked, measured, and reported upon the following year. Because, you know, we are used to hearing just a generic list of here's all the activities that we did. And I think it's time we start focusing on, well, what are the results of those activities? How is this making an impact? How is this, you know, changing either how we approach things? What are the results of these activities? So I know that you have special interest in both climate change and metrics. So if there's, you know, any ideas you have, I would welcome a discussion before Tuesday or after. But that is one thing that Board Member Firestone and I will be following up with staff on. And then the second issue I just wanted to mention, it's not coming before the State Water Board yet, but it is something that I was briefed on recently, and thank you to your Assistant Executive Officer McCann for also being part of that briefing. And that is the Statewide Restoration General Order. This is something that has been in the works for quite a long time. I very much appreciate all the regional water boards' involvement in the development of this general order, this draft general order, especially Region 2, because I know you have special concerns with respect and special expertise with respect to restoration projects. And, you know, I just want to give you a heads up, and again, not getting into the details because it would not be appropriate, but from what I'm hearing, and I think maybe some of you might have heard as well, there might be some issues associated with the draft order that I think we're hoping to be released later this spring. And as you know, when contemplating any order, especially a statewide order, there is this need to balance between statewide consistency and yet also providing the necessary flexibility to address regional specific concerns. And that's always a challenge. And in this particular case, I think an additional challenge is that we all want to promote support, and the intent of the order is to speed up the approval of this restoration project, because they are intended to do so much good for habitat restoration, for water quality protection. So finding that balance, finding that sweet spot, I think is always challenging, but I think it's going to be especially challenging for this. And so as we go forward, again, I would really appreciate your staff continue engagement on this matter. And I know that they will keep an open mind and work with all of the parties involved and help us find that sweet spot for this very complicated but very important effort.
Are there any questions for State Board Member Dudok?
You know, Jim, I'll bite on that for a minute. Tam, thank you so much for being here and for the report out. I have also been hearing quite a bit through environmental circles in the Bay Area about this upcoming statewide general restoration order. Agree with your assessment that, you know, it has to meet the state overall, and the Bay Area has some specific concerns and needs and experience that all needs to be rolled into this. What is the overall timing on this order? Can you say more about the process and timing of all of this?
Let me consult with my cheat sheet here, but my understanding is that it is hoped that the order will be released as a draft for public comment sometime this spring. So, you know, within the next few months or so, we would also be holding a public hearing on it. And the anticipated board consideration of the order is sometime this fall. Now, obviously, that, you know, may change depending on, you know, how the conversation goes. But that is the timeline that I was briefed on by staff. And I don't know, Lisa, do you have any further updates than that? Okay.
Is this part of the, I was watching email yesterday about the cutting the green tape initiative? Okay.
It is.
Okay. Great.
It is part of the that initiative. And it's also, something that we hope would be useful for, statewide critical projects such as restoration being done at the Salton Sea, the New River. So it is something that we very much would like to get done as soon as possible, but, we also need to do it right.
Yeah. Okay. It sounds, from the buzz I'm hearing and your emphasis, it sounds like an important piece of work. And so I'm optimistic that we'll get there. Yeah. Thanks, Tam.
Michael, I see your hand raised. I see yours as well, Alexis. After
maybe let's hear from Board Member Hacker first.
Board Member Hacker, go ahead.
Thank you. And thank you, Board Member Doduck. I'm so glad that you and Lowell Firestone are taking on metrics. When you asked for a few suggestions, are you interested in suggestions around the full panoply of activities that the state and regional boards do, or focused in a particular area?
The full, as long as there's some connection to climate change, either mitigation or more likely for most of us, adaptation.
And then secondly, I just wanted to join the vice chair in echoing how important it is that we find common ground through the upcoming general order so that we can do more to spur more on the ground restoration and overcome some of the obstacles to landowners being willing to do this. So if there's anything that I can help to do with our managers and staff, I'd be glad.
Thank you.
Michael, go ahead. Then I have a few comments.
Yeah, thanks. So thank you, Board Member Doduck, for bringing up the large habitat restoration order, filling us in. We see it as being a very useful tool for restoration projects, and we really appreciate that State Board has accommodated some of the language changes that we've asked for, and that the order as currently written is something we can certainly live with. The concern that I'd say the primary concern, there were a couple of different concerns, but the primary concern that our comments wanted to address was the ability for the regional boards to off-ramp projects that were trying to present themselves as restoration projects, but were not in fact restoration projects. And that's really important. We have, we're of all the regions, we do the most restoration work. We have very professional restoration practitioners on staff. And we just want to be sure that we're not stuck in a position where we're permitting projects that are transportation projects or flood projects or other types of projects that are trying to cast themselves as restoration. And I think State Board understands this issue and has crafted the appropriate language. So as long as we can adhere to those guardrails, we should be great.
Thank you all, and thank you, Board Member Doduck. I'd like to zoom in on this just a little bit. I've been involved with using dredge material for habitat restoration for just about 30 years now. And before that, about 20 years about mitigation and the like. And I certainly don't have the same attitudes that I did when I started. There are two things that I want to stress. First of all, the sediment needs that we have are vast. SFEI, and Andy knows this because we both got an email from Werner Chabot. SFEI is about to release a report on how much sediment is actually needed. So people need to understand the scale of what it will take to keep up with sea level rise and not lose our habitat and our public access along the shoreline. Second, we need to be aware not just of the funding constraints that come from interpretations by the Corps of Engineers about their material, but more generally about the sensitivity of restoration costs. And so anything that brings down the cost and recognizes the vital nature of this. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit later about some of the things in the East Bay, but certainly the use of dredge material from boating facilities and boating channels could be done if we could figure out ways to acceptably define ways to use that in bay and mechanisms for construction that have reasonable costs and reasonable impacts. So I'd allow this, and Michael, I'd ask you to send me a link to it so I could take a quick look at this from my own perspective, which includes consideration of things like the resilience efforts of the Park District. So further comments? Go ahead.
No, you were just on mute, so we couldn't hear you.
The whole time?
Just at the very end.
All right. Well, I think that you got the gist of my comments.
I got the action item.
Okay, let's turn to board member reports. Board Member Gunther.
Thank you, Jim. I just wanted to briefly report on some lessons I'm taking from the recent problems with the grid in Texas. I'm going to set aside the idea that elected leaders in Texas have been making irrational statements not based on evidence. You can read more about this in my recent blog post if you want, which I titled, "We Don't Have Time for This Nonsense." But the real thing is important is the resilience to climatic extremes that we know can be created, and it's essential for public health and safety. And regulatory agencies like ours play a role in providing incentives for this to occur and then tracking progress and demanding accountability. I would note that in Texas, despite the cold snaps in 1989 and 2011, there was not enough incentive for winterization, and it didn't happen except in the city of El Paso, where the municipal utility made changes and the city was spared the worst of the impacts. And so I just want to make sure that we keep this lesson in mind as we move forward to make the Bay Area more resilient to climate change. I mean, I think that our current practice of working with the regulatory community and other stakeholders is the right way to go. And that if we continue to have this kind of focus, it will pay dividends both on certain events in the coming years, but also, you know, over the long term to make us much more prepared for the changes that are coming.
Thank you.
That's my report.
Anything further?
Nope.
Board Member Hacker.
Nothing to add. Thank you.
Board Member Kissinger.
Well, I'll just pick up on what Andy just said, which I think is well said, and just add the added view. You know, I was paying a lot of attention to what's going on in Texas as well, since that's the space I occupy in my day job before the California Public Utilities Commission and the work that I do there. And I think the lesson to be learned from Texas and Board Member Gunther's point just now is that the work has to be done years and years in advance. And so I'd really emphasize, you know, you have to do this work before the crisis is upon you, because once the crisis is upon you, there's nothing you can do. And so I wholeheartedly endorse what Board Member Gunther just said.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to know it looks the same to you.
It does.
Agreed. Board Member Beth?
I'll just add three and say I agree with all those comments on what's been happening in Texas. I have a sister that lives in Houston and who grew up, as I did, in New England. And she and her husband were woefully unprepared for what was about to happen. In addition to everything about large-scale planning, individual planning for resiliency and crisis at the extremes. is just was another reminder about that as well for me. That my only report out today is just to share that I last night attended, actually in the last month, I've attended two lectures put on by POST, Peninsula Open Space Trust, and they're doing an environmental series heavily focused on climate, but it also addresses broader environmental issues. Last month, they had Aaron Brockovich. This last night, they had Michael Mann, a climate scientist. Andy, I don't know if that is someone you know. He has a new book out. He was in Australia when the fires started there, left early because of COVID to return to California, only to be on top of the fires here. And anyway, you can find it on their website. There's no charge for it. It's a wonderful series, and they have great speakers every month. So I encourage that. I learned a lot. I also did not sleep last night because Michael Mann's comments and forecasts around climate were nightmare inducing. So they definitely caught my attention, but very informative. Andy, I'm going to send you the link later, and you can tell me what you think of it. So,
thanks. Mike has forgotten more about climate science than I've ever known. For those of you who don't know, Mike Mann was the senior author of the work that first created what has been called the hockey stick graph, showing based on proxy measurements going back about 1,000 years that temperatures on the planet are changing in ways that we haven't seen before, and has been at the forefront of trying to bring these issues before the public, has paid a significant price in terms of attacks on his credibility. Unlike many other people who might sort of fade away when faced with that situation, Mike has rededicated himself to bringing issues before the public. Doesn't surprise me he's speaking in a POST event. He's written extensively, and he's fighting back very, very strongly against the attacks on his reputation with significant success. He writes regularly in Forbes magazine, which is, a great forum. I would certainly take his prognostications seriously, even if it means you lose a little sleep.
Yeah. He's really unhappy with the fossil fuel industry, and he is not optimistic. That's my summary. But worth listening to. I'll send the link out to everyone. Thanks.
Great. I was just sending you an email to ask you to do that. So,
all right. I have a few things to report. Going back, two conversations that I had, one in February after our board meeting with Michael, we spoke to the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies about our priorities for the year and the importance of both innovation, which I certainly think they're a font of, and collaboration, particularly in the arena of sea level rise, where efforts that collaborate among entities have a better chance of being implemented and receiving funding. I also spoke to a group of students, I believe that they were at Cal, who've been doing work on the possibility of reintroducing sea otters to San Francisco Bay. And they asked me if the board would support it. And I said, well, I can't speak for the board, but it raises interesting questions if it's a keystone species, as some think, and what the food availability would be, because San Francisco Bay is not what it was like. Interesting kids, interesting idea, and we can kind of pay attention to it. I gave broad support for restoration, which I've been doing for many, many years. Two more things. The first is just reports on the homeless issues. There are two things to draw your attention to. One is the state auditor has issued a report about the state's efforts and what needs to be done. The summaries, I think, are succinct in a few words. They want to see a clear action plan and music to I think Tam in my ears would have metrics and steps along the way. There's another effort tomorrow locally that's I think by the Bay Area Council on those efforts, and then in I think it was yesterday's San Jose Mercury or perhaps the day before there was a report on the use of NGOs for cleanup along Coyote Creek in San Jose and Santa Clara. This is an issue that we've dealt with and an issue that I've been down to tour with Richard McMurtry. Only some of it's in our lane, but the public health aspects and the water quality aspects are indeed in our lane, and it's a terrible one. Then the last item on my agenda, but perhaps the most interesting, is I spoke last Thursday, virtually, of course, at the East Bay Regional Park District's executive committee of their board on an effort that's been underway for some time that my attention was first called to by Julie Beagle. It's called Managing Shoreline Parks in a Changing Climate. They received a grant to look at their facilities. Initially, they kind of focused on the Bay Trail and try to predict what they would need to do. I think this is consistent with what Bill has said and Andy has said, that you have to do your work early and you have to know what that work is. I was extremely impressed by the report. The staff person on it was Chantel Alatorre, and I had talked to her at some point along the way and tried to bring her attention to the broader perspective of the board's efforts on the adaptation atlas. The Park District board was extremely receptive. I had sent them an email that said, make no small plans, and they liked that. I gave the proper citation to the original thinker. Their current plans, and this is where it comes close to us, are they've identified two high priority pilot areas. One, the Hayward Shoreline, where the Hayward Area Shoreline Planning Agency, I believe it's called HASP, has completed a plan. David Lewis called my attention to that. And what's relevant to us are a couple of things. First of all, that's part of the overall salt pond restoration effort, which includes a replumbing of Alameda Creek and ways to try to make that shoreline more resilient and make the wetlands function more coherently with the bay and with the tidal system rather than remnants to a level of damage that was done inadvertently when the original flood control project was put in. What's of particular interest to us and the need for involvement in strategic partnerships, as they put it, is there are two landfills along that. And so trying to figure out how to integrate a shoreline resilience plan with closed landfills and sea level rise is something where I think there needs to be cooperation. The other area is the South Basin, the North Basin in the state park, which is the basin of land behind Caesars Fez Park, just offshore between University Avenue and Gilman in Berkeley. That's the location where my picture with Sylvia McLaughlin was taken, as I took her up to show her Schoolhouse Creek and try to promote the idea of restoration of Schoolhouse Creek. I was absolutely thrilled to see that the restoration concept that they have includes restoration around Schoolhouse Creek. And to bring up the question of sediment, one of the things that I've noted in that basin is that because Schoolhouse Creek is essentially completely channelized in a watershed that's largely built out and with a very high degree of impervious surface, generates almost no sediment. So you have a restoration effort as part of the state park up on what's called the Meadow. That's a freshwater system that will eventually be subject to tidal inundation. And you have a basin which is not recovering from the fill activities around it because there's no sediment. This is one of those opportunities to use dredge material from recreational boating facilities to begin to create a wetland system that makes more sense in terms of the models that we have. So I will continue to focus on that. I also encourage them to look at the state plan for that park, which is now 21, 22 years old, which has nothing about sea level rise and adaptation to sea level rise. And it's rather ironic that it has a series of policies to protect the habitat within the Emeryville Crescent, but nothing to recognize that that habitat may well be eroding away due to the alteration in sediment delivery after the gold rush and sea level rise. Very impressive effort. I think it's one of those partnerships. And I think I really appreciate Tam's comments about establishing metrics, because as we think about how we start to move these things forward, I think it will inform us on what metrics we need to do to make significant progress, but orderly progress, and according to the priorities of what's at greatest risk. So that completes my report. I'll turn to Michael.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to check that the other board members, I may have missed it, but were there other board members that had still to report out? No? Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. So before I get into some of the items on the executive officer's report, there's a situation with a stranded vessel I just wanted to mention. This is something that I'd hope had been resolved, would be resolved before today, but it remains a concern that we're tracking. There's a 90-foot long fishing vessel that's stranded up on the coast above Dillon Beach on the border of our region and region one. It was a fishing vessel that was being towed down from Washington, and they ran into a mechanical issue, and they were able to get the towing vessel back to port, but the fishing vessel ended up stranded on the coast. Coast Guard and the OSPR, the state response agency, is working. They've been able to board the ship. They estimate there's about 7,000 gallons of fuel type oils and fuels, and they're tracking it. It's been boomed. I can provide additional information if the board is interested, but we're getting regular reports from Marin County, the State Wildlife Office of Spill Prevention Response, that's OSPR, and the Coast Guard. They're the lead agencies. So just wanted to give you all a heads up on that.
Mike, question.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Is that a viable fuel and to move it that they are intending on bringing it to a port and not sinking it offshore as the Coast Guard is wanting to do?
I don't think we know if there are disposal plans for the vessel at this point. I think the primary concern is either getting it off and offloading the fuels, or there has been very limited observation of a light sheen in the immediate vicinity of the boat itself.
My only point in raising it is, to the extent that we're involved, if we know that they are thinking of abandoning the vessel, that they would need to get an EPA permit in advance and not after the fact.
Okay.
That's it. Thanks.
All right. I can check and see that EPA is involved.
Can we also check and see? I would be rather shocked if they towed a vessel from Seattle here with a fuel load. I would hope not.
Yeah, I don't know the circumstances of that. I'm sure the fuel tank is large. It sounds like it wasn't necessarily full. Yeah, I mean, I can certainly ask about that, although it is a bit after the fact. I mean, it kind of is what it is in terms of what they're dealing with. Okay, so moving on to the executive officer's report, wanted to talk a little bit about the Caltrans. You've all had a chance to see the Save the Bay letter from yesterday, encouraging us to accelerate the resubmission of the work plan. And talking with staff, and you know, it's really my feeling that we gave them very specific direction in the letter that we had sent, that they should be focusing on really getting on the same page with us around feasibility of installation of structural devices in right of way, so that we can drill down on this issue of alternative compliance. And that's where we'd like them to focus their efforts. That's where we need to focus our staff efforts, so that we can know by the end of the year just how far apart we may be in terms of alternative compliance. You know, we do have one dedicated staff person, but majority of our watershed staff are really going to be focusing almost exclusively on the reissuance of the municipal regional stormwater permit over the next 7 to 8 months. And I don't advise that we move up the work plan. Instead, we can certainly report out on progress on the questions that, you know, were raised in the response that we sent back to Caltrans, so that the board's appraised of progress that's being made. But it, I don't believe it makes sense for us to change the schedule there.
Let's stick with that a minute and see if there's any board questions or comments on the Caltrans issue. Alexis, I see your hand.
Thank you. I'm hopeful that we, you know, last year we went through a similar pattern as I joined the board in February, and it would be ideal for us to not go through the next 9 months to then come up to a work plan in December and kind of reset again. And I'd like to have a better sense of progress quarter by quarter. So could we plan to discuss how things are going in much greater detail as a board in June or July?
Yeah, I think we can, there's a dialectic here on the trash control devices between what is happening at the local level and what's happening with Caltrans. So we can certainly come back and appraise the board as to where we're at with regards to on right-of-way versus off right-of-way solutions being identified by Caltrans. We know from the experiences you referred to last year that Caltrans has made a commitment to bring adequate funding to the table, which was significant. So now it's just a question of where and how that gets spent towards the goal of them meeting their targets in 2022.
I think it would just be great. I'm not a fan of the paper submittal having to come at a particular time as much as having a more in-depth discussion among the board members with the key participants, whether Caltrans and or others. But I'd like us to have a better on-the-ground situation. Every week I see what Caltrans is doing at Ashby and what they're doing at university. And it just feels like an amoeba that is just moving around between those two intersections of trash coming up. I don't have a feel for what's happening importantly in the other parts of the bay. And so I just would appreciate if we scheduled a much more detailed discussion among us. Thanks.
Sure.
And
Bill?
And apropos to that, I absolutely agree that we ought to kind of be posted how progress is being made. But I think the key goal should be that what is submitted in December, if that's going to be the deadline by which they submit the revised work plan, that we're all confident, I mean, that water board staff knows exactly what it's going to look like by then, that it's not going to come in and there's still, you know, a shortfall or a gap, but rather that there's a process in place so that one person, Mike, that's working with Caltrans is keeping their feet to the fire so sure. That we don't have to let this, you know, that we don't get put in this position where we've got to give them more time or come down like a ton of bricks. We ought to know that the progress is being made between now and then. It's a very long period of time. I am sympathetic to the Save the Bay letter, but I take the point of limited resources and the need to figure out how to best allocate it. We should make sure that the people that we have on this are making sure that the work is getting done to get there.
Yeah, and progress is being made, you know, both on and off right of way. Yeah, so I mean, I appreciate the comment. It was aggressive, fairly aggressive targets that were set, and it's going to, you know, I personally don't believe that, you know, it's going to be way off, but it will come down. I think it will come down to the wire. I mean, it's a lot of work to get done in a short period of time, but we'll be able to update the board on the progress.
Jane, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I guess I just want to add my voice to that. And I spoke with Mike about this yesterday. I am respectful and sympathetic to the Save the Bay wanting to move the deadlines up. That, and I take enforcement and compliance very seriously. And so, you know, I want to see that. At the same time, when we talk about what's happening statewide with homelessness and the financial situation, you know, people are finding themselves in, I am concerned that we're moving things around around the state, not really solving the problem. And I know that quickly gets beyond our scope of authority or responsibility. But I think it would be helpful for this board to fully understand the scope of the problem from like how we fit in the state and just to both be persistent and asking for compliance, but compassionate about the issues that we face as a state, which are just so significant. I've been getting a little bit of a front row seat on this recently because Half Moon Bay, I think I shared with you guys that San Mateo County purchased a hotel as transitionary housing. And we are seeing people that are experiencing homelessness spend some time at the hotel and then find housing. So there are some success stories coming, but that is a different situation than what we're looking at with Caltrans compliance. But I obviously can hear I'm concerned about solving the problem, not just the symptom of the problem. So anyway, and can I just also mention here on the coast, the wind has kicked up enormously. It is hailing. And so we'll see how long the power lasts.
I'll add my comments. I concur in what's been previously said by the board, particularly the importance of some traction and overall coherent plan for managing the homeless issues, which is something that Caltrans is, it's perhaps they're not their core mission, and something that baffles them as well as many local governments. It's a very difficult and complicated issue. I agree with Mike that the priority at the moment in terms of our resources is the MS4 reissuance and the discussions on that. Having been involved, I know how heavy the lift to get the funding was really. And with all due respect to Save the Bay and their immense help at moving the rock as far as it's been moved, at this point, I think it's very important to make sure that that money is well spent and that it is spent with facilities that can be maintained. And in my discussions with Michael and the other staff members, trying to get Caltrans to focus on the highest priorities in the strategic partnerships with local governments rather than wait for them, I think is the work that staff is devoted to. And I'm convinced that that's the most important work rather than trying to accelerate. I want to see that money spent well. So Michael, go ahead with your report.
Thank you. So moving on to the item on the Oakland Army Base contaminated sediments, this is, you know, this work that's conducted by the Army is under CERCLA. Superfund isn't a statute that we deal a lot with, but it is Important for the board to be aware of this because we are elevating the issue with the Army and DTSC. There is, you know, not widespread, but substantial areas of contamination within the offshore sediments near this base, and public access is being increased significantly by the creation of a park, which is it's a good thing. We just need to make sure that the sediments are adequately cleaned up. As you all know, there are ongoing PCB contamination issues in sport fish and fish in the mid bay. SFVI has done a really good job in tracking fish tissue concentrations for PCBs. And we are also going, as part of the municipal regional permit, to be asking municipalities to spend a lot of money to keep PCBs out of the bay. So I feel it's our obligation to make sure that federal agencies are addressing the legacy PCB contamination. I'll be meeting with the Army executive staff along with DTSC in the next couple of weeks. So just a heads up on that. Also be briefing agency on this matter. Any questions on Oakland Army Base? Okay. Big congratulations to the Point Buckler team. This is an amazing victory. It's not entirely over, but it's a big step. I want to thank Office of Counsel, Cameron Austin, the other attorneys who contributed over time, the Attorney General's Office, and the staff who dedicated themselves to this effort over many years, even former AEO Diane White, which was who was a champion on this matter. So thanks again to staff, Javier, Keith, and the other staff that contributed on this. There is an article I will share that came out yesterday in Bay Nature magazine, which I think is a very nice read. A little bit, I would say, more even-handed than some of the other press that's been given a story. The other thing I wanted to bring up was the Summer Hill item under the executive officer's report. We included this mainly to illustrate how we are trying to reinforce the importance of operating and maintaining vapor intrusion mitigation systems when we're dealing with developers and HOAs, and making sure that we have more direct recourse to situations that we might find where those systems have been become inoperable or have not been properly maintained. So this is an ongoing effort. It's tied back to some of the priorities that we talked about with the board last year and prior years about addressing vapor intrusion and how we view vapor mitigation systems. And then separate from the executive officer's report, I wanted to just generally update the board on staffing. So, you know, we continue to, I think there may be, I don't know what the impact of the passage of the federal COVID relief bill will have on the state of California, but we still have staff who are taking leave days, and we still have staff that are doing contact tracing. So we remain down, you know, 10-15% staffing wise. And we will hopefully see that abate as we will hopefully get our contact tracers back as the counties like the Bay Area has enter into, you know, the red and orange and yellow tiers of the pandemic rating system. Also along the lines of the COVID response work, we have registered in Alameda County right now essential. So we have all of our staff are deemed essential, but we have a small subset of our staff that are required to come into the office to maintain operations. We also have a few emergency response staff, and we have registered with Alameda County because we expect that in the next 3 to 4 weeks, the category of essential government office workers will become eligible for vaccines. And so for the, you know, roughly 15 to 20 staff that fit in that category for us. We will hopefully be able to get them, based again on their own personal willingness, an opportunity to get a vaccine. Last but not least, I want to wish everybody a happy Women's History Month. We're excited. We've got a staff training coming up next week. Staff's done a great job of putting together a very thoughtful program on visionary, being a visionary regulator. And we have two prominent women from state environmental programs, Felicia Marcus and Meredith Williams, who will both be the keynote speakers during our training. So excited to announce that, and big thanks to staff that have put that training together, and to Felicia and Meredith for participating. And that's it. That's been my report.
Two things real quick. First, it's not news. There's a wonderful article in the current Smithsonian about the woman who was responsible for the intelligence that indicated that the Soviets were putting nuclear missiles in Cuba. She was pretty much run the show, very low key, tougher to be a woman leader at that time. And then lest we go past this, I want to make sure that, Michael, you carry the board's congratulations to Sarah Beth George. I'm never surprised at the excellence of our staff. I just always want to stop a second and say it's recognized.
Thank you. Thank you.
Not what I was hoping you'd say, but...
This brings us to the public swear-in.
Can I just one thing about Mike's report?
You may.
Mike, I just want to thank you for the monitoring data on PCBs and mercury. I happen to have been involved in the crafting of those TMDLs many years ago, so it's particularly interesting for me to see this. But I think that it's really important for the board to remind us, to remind the public, that we have made all of these decisions and we are continuing to follow through on those in collaboration with our permittees, using scientific methods to verify compliance and to understand and track whether our allocations were able to be met, how effectively they've been met, and then of course tracking how the bay slowly changes in response to these long-term pollutants. And so I just really think that it's really, really valuable that we regularly kind of surface this kind of information so that we can just remind you guys can remind me and we can remind everybody else that we don't just make decisions and then assume. We make decisions and then we follow through and we measure. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
That brings us to the rest of our calendar. Michael, do we really need a swearing in at this point since there's no action? And this is all dialogue with the staff?
I believe we will be voting on the resolution, right?
Okay. In that case.
Yuri, sorry.
We'll be voting on the resolution, but it's not an adjudicatory item, so we don't really need to swear in people today.
Oh, so we do not need the swearing in. Thank you.
All right. I did look at the rest of the agenda, and I said, if I can avoid this. So we're going to go to that in a minute. I'm going to give everybody a five-minute break. I think we should be out of here by lunch if we can move swiftly, but I think waiting till lunch to have a break is not in anybody's interest. So let's take a 5-minute break. item 5, streamlining considerations for enforcement. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, so I wanted to provide a little bit of background on, you know, how we arrived to a point where we want to bring this forward to the board, the first item, which is the resolution on EEO being able to hold hearings on MMP, mandatory minimum penalties. And, you know, basically it just came about as a result of a conversation around the amount of work that's involved with enforcement cases and the few staff that we had and how we might be able to create efficiencies. And going back and looking at the practices of other regional boards and asking ourselves if there were opportunities to fine tune our process that might allow us to be more efficient. It was a bit of a realization that we were spending a lot of time with MMPs, and particularly stormwater MMPs, trying to get resolution so that we wouldn't have to bring these small penalties to a full board hearing. And, you know, basically four other boards have the authority for the EO to do the hearings on mandatory minimum penalties. And three of them, it's fairly blanket provision that the stormwater MMPs are basically failure to produce an annual report and non-filing, which could mean, you know, non-filing when they should actually have filed, or you know, failing to basically fill out and they're not included. So the penalties we looked at back at over the last 5 years, and there've been 34 MMPs on annual reporting, 18 MMPs on non-filing. We did a report back in 2013 to the board, and these penalties range from about 1,000 to 14,000. So they're not significant amounts. So we felt like this might be an efficiency. We've been pursuing non-filers, and there may be more work for us on the horizon, but I'll stop there and ask if either of the AEOs or Bill Johnson or Yuri Juan want to add any additional information on background to this. It seemed like a relatively easy process improvement for us to put in place, so we decided to bring it to the board. Bill?
You know, I don't have much to add other than to say that we already have a process for the NPDES wastewater mandatory minimum penalties that works pretty well, where, we work with the dischargers, try to get a settlement and take it to the executive officer to approve those settlements. And I think that would work well with the stormwater as well. But sometimes we can't get a settlement. Not for lack of trying, but, you know, these are sort of smaller entities. We may get ignored and whatnot. And sometimes we just need a mechanism for getting the mandatory minimum penalty imposed when you can't get the paperwork pulled together because you can't get the other party to sign on the dotted line for a settlement. So actually having, the opportunity to have the executive officer handle the hearing part would be good, rather than having to take it to the full board.
Thanks, Bill. Any questions? Any other staff want to add?
Guy, is there anybody that wishes to speak on this item?
I do have someone who's raised their hand. Kelly has raised his hand. Should I bring him over?
You should. This is noticed as a public hearing and a decision, so we certainly want to hear from the public.
Kelly has been promoted.
Okay. Kelly, go ahead.
Okay. I have a lot of experience with stormwater issues right here in our local area.
at several sites, all in the foothills of the Fremont and Sinol. And the learnings there of enforcement penalties and the lack thereof has provided us, our group, with a recipe, a step-by-step instructions for how to bypass, how to evade stormwater controls. First off, you can file a notice of intent and report the total area to be disturbed as 5.5 acres instead of the actual 20 acres. You can do stormwater inspections through a private contractor and send all the reports to the project proponent, the construction contractor, the property owner, but not to the regional board or to the city, also to the municipality. The municipality can get them, but not the regional board. You can file a notice of termination prematurely to terminate the stormwater inspections and then keep your project going for another couple of years before it's really completed and really terminated. A year and a half after that, you can send county staff to inspect one element or a component of the project that does have permits. Send about seven times a year and a half after the notice of termination. Have the county file those inspection reports properly with the regional board, but that project doesn't officially exist. It's not formally active on the smart stormwater tracking system, and no one notices. It just slips through the cracks. And finally, you can file an SWPPP plan with the lead agency at the commencement of the construction project, but not file the SWPPP with the regional board, even though you tell the municipality you did, but you don't. Local municipality won't issue a permit until if it's still under review, but you can proceed with grading and excavation for a year without a permit and without stormwater inspections and without a permit from local municipality. So there's two lessons here. Better procedures, cross-checking, coordination among all these agencies. And number two, when all else fails, yes, you need to expand the enforcement powers and administrative penalties of the executive officer. But if anybody needs a recipe for how to evade stormwater, right here in Southern Alameda County in Fremont, we are experts. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. I'll turn it to the board and raise your hand with the icon or virtually and see if we have any comments.
I'll jump in for a second, Jim, if that's okay. Mike or Bill, I've been on the board just over 4 years now, and I would like to get a sense of how much of this is already being, like, how much of a change is this from the board action versus executive officer action? Can you give us a sense of how much of a change this is from the practices that we've been using?
You want me to take that, Michael?
Yeah, please, Bill.
Sure. You know, I don't know that it's a huge difference in terms of what we've been doing, you know, and the speaker just sort of gave you a really good explanation of sort of how much is going on in this realm that we, you know, could be paying better attention to and potentially be taking discretionary actions over. And so the point of the proposal today is to allow us to be a little bit more efficient in some of the more basic cases of, you know, has somebody enrolled, have they filed their annual report or not? And so that we're not spending as much time on that to free up our resources to spend things on higher priorities where there is maybe something more egregious going on. So what it really means is we're trying to create a mechanism where someone can still have their due process to have, you know, to have a chance to say, here's my case, here's why, you know, this mandatory minimum penalty should not apply, and have the executive officer make that decision instead of having to package it all and bring it to the board and having, you know, a board item, board hearing, all that formality that goes on with that. It takes a lot of your time and it potentially takes a lot of our time. And it's actually sort of a high stakes environment for what are really very low penalties. And, you know, $1,000, no more than $5,000 per incident. And so, you know, we just want to make sure that we're not spending all of our time on efforts that are actually, you know, should be small and handled with swiftly and efficiently.
Yeah, I just feel like I don't know that we've had any of those hearings in the 4 years that I've been here. Have we had any?
I think that the reason we haven't had them is because we have really spent an enormous amount of effort trying to avoid them and tracking people down, tracking down our notices. You know, the requirement is that we send out two notices and tell people, you know, we have a problem here, please fix it. And, you know, once we send that second notice, if it's not resolved, there should be a mandatory minimum penalty. But there we can send out a proposed settlement letter that says, you know, okay, we propose to settle this problem for the minimum penalty. And it just takes a lot of effort to get that piece of paper back when, in fact, it would actually be more straightforward to just say, look, we've told you a couple times, we've given you a chance to come to us and tell us, you know, if there's any reason we should not penalize you, to tell us, but then let's swiftly just issue the penalty instead of bringing it to the board with a board action. So we have, you know, there are a lot of permittees in this program. And so, you know, when we pursue this each year or two, you know, we're looking at, for instance, non-filers or, you know, people who haven't submitted their annual reports. We're talking about numbers and of the magnitude of like 70, 80, 90 people that, you know, are, you know, organizations that then we're contacting and mailing letters to and trying to get whittle that number down to a manageable point. So you see that the penalties we've imposed, we imposed, you know, through settlement. But to be quite frank about it, you know, the way the law works is that we have to give those two notices, and we may refrain from giving that second notice to avoid the labor associated with taking it to the board, right? So rather than giving that second notice, we may just keep continuing to work with them and work with them, but we really need a more efficient way of saying, you know what, we've given you two notices. Now, it's not going to be the labor of taking it to the board. We've got a more efficient way of handling this and then just moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And I assume if someone wanted to object to that process, they can always come to the board. They can come to a public meeting of the board. They can, yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Other comments?
Mr. McGrath, if I may, I just wanted to mention that having the EO hold the hearing on the MMP doesn't bypass the process. They will get their fair hearing, and we will hear their, or the EO will hear their comments and adjudicate the case much like the board will. It's just that the full board will not be involved, especially on matters where the board does not have much discretion on MMPs.
Thank you, Yuri. To me, that's the critical point. While I do respect the ability of the public to kvetch about the staff to the board. I mean, that's one of the roles we have. Here, we don't have the discretion. There are mandatory minimums. And as I think Bill Johnson pointed out, the opportunity to focus on those things that are more important to get them either to a resolution matter, which is really our ultimate objective, or before the board is what's important. And I think this does cut some red tape. So I'm supportive of this. If there's no further comment, I think we have a resolution, do we not, Michael?
Yuri's volume go up a little bit, that would be so helpful. Thank you.
Mm. I'm having audio difficulties, so I'm trying to talk as loudly as possible.
Michael, I see your hand. Go ahead.
Yes, there's a resolution that we provided to the board in the package that we recommend that the board adopt.
Is there any further discussion on this? Did I hear a motion or a start of a motion?
Yeah.
Jane moves the motion.
I second.
Alexis seconds. Any further discussion? Guy, would you call the roll, please?
Board Member Gunther?
Yes.
Board Member Hecker?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Batty?
Aye.
Chair McGrath?
Aye. So ordered. Michael, item B.
Yeah, thank you. So in the context of that conversation that we had, that where we identified the resolution that was just adopted, we also discussed, ways to, prepare the board for more challenging enforcement hearings. We talked about training. Obviously, enforcement matters. When we bring these cases to the board, involve complicated penalty calculations. The formulas require some time to understand and to learn how to apply. And if it's the board's intention to adjust the penalty formulation in the hearing process, it's a complicated set of kind of levers that can be pulled or not pulled. There is a really huge importance on understanding and focusing on the facts that the enforcement team has put together. I've certainly been learning about the importance of the advisory role. And one idea that we wanted to bring to the board for discussion was the possibility that the board might want to consider having an enforcement subcommittee. And there's a little bit of background on this, which either Yuri or Bill can cover in terms of the concept already having been adopted for other reasons by the board. We wanted to discuss the pros and cons with the board and see if they were interested in potentially having this as a option for conducting enforcement hearings that would come to the board. So I'll stop there and ask Bill or Yuri to add anything.
Just so that we're all on the same page as to what we're talking about, the executive officer summary report summarizes the panel hearing process. And so under that process, three or more board members can participate in a panel and adjudicate an ACL, after which there has to be a second hearing where the full board or quorum thereof hears the case, the recommendation of the panel, and independently reviews the record and takes testimony and then makes a full decision. So this process has always been allowed under the Water Code. However, we've not used it, and nor have many other regional boards, because it is perceived as inefficient in that it requires two hearings. But that said, this is something that the board can do, and the pros and cons are enunciated in the OSR. And so, with that, we're just asking for the board input and get your thoughts on it. This is not an action item. It's just for us to understand where the board is on this issue.
Yuri, a question for you, and I think Andy may have been exposed to this. There is a similar process, but I'm not sure that it's identical, that BCDC uses. And when it comes to the full board, the full board can take it up de novo. They can endorse the enforcement committee's action, or they can send it back to the enforcement committee. So there's a couple of questions here. So wait for a second. So the part of the question that I have is, Do we have to change or establish regulation similar to what BCDC has in order to implement this? And then I'd like Andy to comment on his experience and your own comments. So that's the question: is this an elaborate administrative process to begin to do this? And what would it really look like?
Okay, well, just a couple of things. So the panel, the subcommittee hearing is just part one of the hearing. It's not as if the panel makes the decision. The panel does the hearing where it takes evidence, hears witnesses, hears testimony, and makes a proposed decision. After that, the full board also must review the record. So it's not as if it's just delegating everything to the panel. It's that the panel goes first and then the board goes second. With respect to your question about the additional processes, we do not have to adopt regulations. However, if this is something that the board wants to entertain, I would recommend that the board authorize the chair to appoint the panel members as you see fit. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it doesn't require regulation. So let's turn to the board members and ask whether or not what their reaction is.
Well, Jim, for BCDC, there's a sort of an added wrinkle in that BCDC has been revising its enforcement program extensively pursuant to an interaction with the state legislature that all happened before I got there. So I'm not quite sure that I can give you a perspective on it. I have been involved in a couple of enforcement decisions, one in which the full board endorsed the enforcement committee's decision, another one in which the full board heard additional comments and then decided to refer the matter back to the enforcement committee for further work. But I'm not sure that the situation is exactly the same as Yuri is describing, where the full BCDC board must, in essence, hear again the testimony that was delivered to their enforcement committee. And if that's the case, it certainly seems a little bit duplicative and inefficient from my perspective for us to adopt this policy.
Thank you, Andy. Other comments?
So first a question and then a comment. To Yuri, how does the rest of the board conduct its independent review? Would the enforcement committee have a court reporter and create a transcript, or would it be recorded and that would be made available to the remainder of the board? How do they conduct that independent review?
That is a very good question. And so we would have a court reporter attend the panel hearing and provide a transcript, and the full board members would have to review that transcript as well as all of the evidentiary submittals in order for the full board to make a decision.
Yeah. My reaction to this is, if there's a really complicated matter that it's just difficult, given our regular monthly meetings, to get that done, I think there may be unusual cases where it might make sense to do something like this. But, in the ordinary course, it's not clear to me that this is a super efficient way to go, particularly when we have a small board. If we had a really big board, I think there might be a stronger argument for doing it. I think we ought to, not take it off the table. And I think it's the kind of thing that maybe, Jim as chair and with Mike, or, Jim and Jane, as chair and vice chair, ought to be open to considering that, given the flow of work we have, that it, you know, maybe as a safety valve to allow us to keep our board meetings to, you know, the single day, and rather than making them go into multi-day scenarios. But I, you know, in the years that I've been on the board, I'm thinking about the cases that we've had, and we seem to have managed to move them through in a way that kept us within, you know, our usual once, you know, a month, daily, one day settings. I mean, even just thinking about Point Buckler, thinking, would that have been advantage by doing it? That's the only one I can think of where it maybe it might have made sense. But even there, you know, as the recent Court of Appeals decision made clear, came out well. Go ahead.
So one thing I failed to mention is that many years ago when the board was having quorum problems, we did adopt, this was statewide because just, you know, the governor's office was having problems with appointments. So what many of the regional boards did, including this board, was we adopted a resolution that allowed panel hearings where a quorum could not be convened. So we have that ability. To me, when we have issues like that, you know, a panel hearing is very advantageous. But beyond that, you know, my personal opinion is that it is inefficient.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I can. But I think it's a tool that we should have, you know, currently we already have the ability to do it and have done it. So.
Other board members? I'll offer, go ahead, Alexis.
But to give ourselves this tool doesn't mean that we have to use it every time. And so my suggestion for my colleagues' consideration is that we could endorse this option and use it where we want to use it rather than having of a moment to try and create it. So I suggest that we establish this and then determine with the management team and Mike when it's appropriate to use it.
Yeah, I agree.
So yeah, so then we could leave the door open and to facilitate panel hearings more quickly in the future would be to expand the previous resolution that the board adopted, allowing the board to the chair to appoint the panel. So we would expand that resolution to include circumstances beyond when a quorum cannot be convened.
Just flexibility.
Yes.
I like the comments of board member Kissinger and Hacker. And I think having it as a potential tool is a way to go. I do see a potential benefit. I'm mindful of the fact that when you as a board member serve in a decision-making role on a violation, you are an ombudsman for people who feel that they may be unfairly targeted for enforcement. And you have to be scrupulous in paying attention to both sides, and it's set up procedurally to do that. I am a little bit worried that setting up the benefit of having a panel is it may be in a position to tell the staff, well, here's, you know, question A or question A and B or question A, B and C that we don't think are sufficiently analyzed for us to take a final action on this, and essentially send it back for more work. But I am also worried that the other side, the perception might be that having heard in a committee or a subcommittee or a panel, board members would lose their neutrality. So I think its application has to be very careful because of the, not necessarily the unfair nature of it, but the perception that people would have made up their mind and would be not as open to testimony in the full hearing. And that's different than in BCDC, where your initial reaction is to say, that's close enough, you know, that the body of information before us is sufficient. You're not hearing it de novo. But when the full board has to hear it de novo, the question that bothers me a little bit is, have you biased the system by having it run through a panel first? Go ahead, Yuri.
That's very considerate on your part. The legislature has anticipated this, and in the statute it says that the panel members may participate in the full board hearing as well. So there is no prejudice.
And the legislative language is clear enough that that would be insulated from any collateral attacks. Yuri.
That's my opinion, but okay. you never know.
I see Michael's hand and Tom's hand and no other board member's hand. Michael? You're muted, Michael.
I'm sorry, Tom, why don't you go ahead?
Yes, well, I just want to offer the potential scenario would be where this may be in your interest would be when we would be bringing many discretionary enforcement cases to you, which would result in a very burdensome regular board meeting. And there may be, there may be circumstances where the panel approach could be more efficient in terms of giving everybody an initial hearing, as Chair McGrath said, an opportunity for the board panelists to give staff some perspective on what the panel at least would want to see in the case. But it is a potential means of managing lots of cases, but at the same time, we'd have to be wary that is it going to be inefficient because we're going to end up having dual hearings for a lot of cases. If you know, we might need to just have that tool available, and I like where I'm hearing board members say that they were open to having that tool, and we may learn from experience where it may be an efficient way to give a lot of violators an opportunity for a good hearing and make the regular board meetings more efficient. So it hasn't happened much, as you may know, that we bring lots of cases to you, but there is always the potential as our enforcement efforts evolve and we target new territory where we might find lots of cases that need attention, and there might be some benefit of batching through the panel process as a two-step process rather than ever bringing everything straight to the board.
Michael?
Yeah, I would add that we brought this with through the lens that, of a full board. So Bill board member Kissinger had sort of asked about, well, the board's relatively small now, but it could grow, you know, ideally we'll get to a 7 board members and we'll have some relatively new members who may or may not be familiar with wearing, you know, what I like to call the enforcement hat. And you get used to wearing that hat either by being on the, you know, being on the delivering end of enforcement decision-making or sometimes through prior experience, as the case with board member Hacker, McGrath and Batty, who were either on the giving enforcement or on the receiving enforcement end of the business model there. And so, I guess my point is simply that I do think experience is important and can help to bring along less experienced board members. And that's a potential tool of having this, is that you do run, you know, you can run challenging things through a subset of the board that has greater experience with that.
Jim, Chair McGrath, I'd just like to add that I really agree with all the comments that have been given so far. The one, I think I do have a bias to, as long as we are, even 7 board members is not a very big board compared to, you know, other entities. And I think that through the enforcement process, we often learn a lot. And I know that I really enjoy and appreciate the questions that board members ask and the perspectives they bring. And I can definitely see it as a tool. If, like, as Tom says, that there's a lot of cases or something unique, but my bias is probably towards the full board, as long as it's manageable.
So Michael, I'd like to move us along. I think you've received guidance that this is a potential tool which should be used sparingly. And then I'll offer an editorial comment that the two times that the Port of Oakland found itself in enforcement proceedings, it deserved it. So, and it was far more expensive to have done it the wrong way than to have done it the right way. What can I say?
I may have missed it subtly in the direction there. Are we to draft a resolution for board consideration, or are we going to hold off on that?
Yuri, I don't think it requires a resolution. This is a tool that's available to us should we think we need it. Is that correct? Yes,
that is correct. But so if we wanted to, you know, do this, say, 2 months from now, instead of having the board, you know, convene and appoint the panel members, it would be more efficient if the chair can do so on his own. And so I would recommend expanding the existing resolution that allows the chair to do that to encompass situations beyond when a quorum cannot be convened. So we'll bring that resolution forward to you for your consideration, and with the understanding that we'll use panel hearings when the need arises.
Sounds good.
I may.
Alexis.
Taking into account each board member's comments, I think it would be ideal to regular conversations that you as chair and Jane as vice chair have with the executive officer. There may be, as you set the agenda for the forthcoming meetings, there may be opportunities where you see, per what Tom had said, that there's a group of simple cases that are fairly straightforward, where it would be a more efficient use of this board's time to use the panel to dispense with the simple cases. I think we should always push ourselves to be more efficient and apply this tool where it will help us. I'm cognizant that in the several months ahead of us, we're going to be spending a lot of time on vetting the development of the stormwater permit and hearing from many co-permittees. We're going to be doing all of our other board business. And there are things that are much more complicated than some of the simple enforcement cases where we really, as a board, will want to dig in and spend time. So if we can take some of the very simple enforcement matters and handle them as a panel at your and Jane's discretion with Mike, I just think we should establish the panel and have it ready to go, because we have some very significant business ahead of us in the rest of this year.
Understood. Agreed. Michael, you have the direction you need? We'll bring it back at the next meeting.
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you. That brings us to item 6, the Wetland Regional Monitoring Program. We have a presentation.
Thank you. I'm excited to have the board hear about this item. It's something that staff has been working on since 2017. I've heard nothing but accolades from our partners that are working on this effort, this around the staff participation, and in particular around the leadership of Javier Fernandez in helping to, you know, kind of broker understanding amongst the parties about how this can work and the advantages of this program. So I'm going to stop there and hand it over to Javier to introduce our speakers.
Good morning, board. It's my pleasure to introduce two info items today covering activities within our climate change portfolio. This first item is on the Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program, and it will be given by Heidi Nutters from the San Francisco Estuary Partnership, who is chair of the steering committee, and as well as Christina Toms, who is the chair, who's one of my staff, who is the chair of the technical advisory committee. Heidi's going to cover the first part of the presentation. She's going to give a background on the process and where we are at today and where the next steps. And Christina is going to cover the science aspects of it. Heidi, take it away.
Thank you, Javier. Are they going to share the... Oh, it happened magically. Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to speak with you all. As Javier said, I'll be starting the first part of the presentation. I'm the project manager for the Wetland Regional Monitoring Program development process at the Estuary Partnership. And I'm going to provide an overview before we get into some of the science priorities. So next slide. So I'll just start by talking about why regional monitoring, why this focus, and why we think now is the right time to address this issue. First, regional monitoring supports efforts to meet regional objectives. It allows us to implement several regional guidance documents, including the Balanced Goals Science Update and the Estuary Blueprint, or the CCMP, Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan, both of which identify regional monitoring as a significant priority for the upper and lower estuary. Second, it supports climate change adaptation and priority responses at the regional scale. So, you know, through coordinated monitoring that starts with questions of, you know, guiding and management questions of regional significance, we're able to provide info needed for sea level rise and climate change adaptation using existing monitoring data that's being collected out in the field to answer those questions of regional importance. Next, it informs and potentially facilitates project-specific monitoring. So the WRMP will provide guidance on monitoring at the project level through permit conditions where those are adopted by the regulatory agencies. And we're working in very close partnership with all of our regulatory agencies in the San Francisco Bay. Finally, it supports project design and adaptive management via centralized data management and analysis. So this centralized data management can support adaptive management and add value to existing monitoring data. So in our current system, depending on, you know, who's collecting the monitoring information, it often sits on a shelf. And I think, you know, we can all agree that's not an ideal situation. So if we're sharing that data and it's available on a platform that's accessible, it can increase the impact of that data, both to inform decision-making and also for research on the San Francisco Bay locally and beyond. So, you know, bottom line, we think we can achieve greater efficiencies with regional monitoring and that, you know, through a collaborative process. Next. So the scope and focus of the WRMP, the map on the left just shows our project area, which is the lower estuary, San Francisco Bay, including Sassoon. We also coordinate with the Delta. And our goal is to establish a robust and sustainable program with a long-term funding source and sustainable funding, and to better utilize existing data to answer some of the region's most critical questions. So to do more with our data and to maintain an inclusive and collaborative process. So we have kind of four main categories of stakeholders that we work with very closely, regulators, land managers, science institutions, and community organizations, all of whom are at the table in a consensus-based process. Next. This is just a timeline of our development process. We kicked off this process with funding from EPA Region 9. The Wetland Program Development Grant is the funding source. And in January 2018, we established our steering committee. And you can see there's a picture of some of our steering committee members, including Javier, and Christina is on there as well as one of the core team members and now our TAC chair. And I just want to emphasize the partnership that has really made this a successful effort to date. So our key partners include the Water Board and EPA, as I mentioned, as well as the SFEI, the Aquatic Science Center, the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture, and the San Francisco Bay NER, the National Estuarine Research Reserve. So once we established, and as well as all of our steering committee members, obviously, but those are our funded partners. Once we established our steering committee, we set about to develop guiding and management questions and hosted a series of science workshops where we invited experts from all across the region. Those workshops were on physical processes, wildlife response, vegetation management, and vector control and mosquito abatement. We collected a lot of really great information and insight on scientific priorities and used that to develop a science framework in the middle of 2019. And finally, the release of the WRMP program plan in April of 2020 that really focuses on the science in particular. After we completed the plan, we established our technical advisory committee, and there's a photo of all of our TAC members on Zoom. They've been amazing and have met on Zoom through this whole time. Hopefully they can meet in person when it's safe to do so. And as we mentioned, Christina is our TAC chair, and our vice chair is Donna Ball from the San Francisco Estuary Institute. In December of 2020, we released a funding strategy, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And currently, we're working on the development of a program charter. Next. So just to get into some of our activities that we're focused on through last year and this year, as I mentioned, the funding strategy and charter is a big focus to really get this program off the ground. We're working to, or the funding strategy has already actually identified core program functions and costs. We have a three-year work plan with a rough cost assessment for the program, as well as working right now to identify sustainable funding sources. And, you know, we're seeking kind of a diverse portfolio funding that includes some long-term funding sources, as well as grants to support the science of the WRMP, as well as core program staff. And also working to address governance and decision-making to find an organizational home for the program and to finalize our decision-making procedures through a charter. Our science priorities are developed in conjunction with our TAC and steering committee, and Christina's gonna get into that in a minute. I talked a little bit about the data management and delivery system, which is focused on providing guidance and data formatting on quality control, harmonizing data to WRMP standards, and developing standard operating procedures. This work is led by SFEI, ASC. Then the next component of that is training and outreach, focused on basically training on those operating procedures. And as I mentioned, the JV and the NER are the main partners that are doing the training work. And this will happen later in 2021. And finally, our ultimate goal is to move into program implementation and really to move from this development process we've been in into a fully fledged program to establish that long-term funding stream as well as staffing for the program. Next. I mentioned the program plan. There's four main components of the plan. The first and the main focus is the science framework. We're also focused on administration and governance. So that provides options for how the program will be governed. The data management section, which I discussed, and then an implementation roadmap, which we're basically currently working on at the moment. Next. So just to get into a little bit of the monitoring framework and how we see this being implemented on the ground, I talked a little bit about those guiding and management questions, which are really developed to address the key management issues of critical importance for our region. The monitoring program framework is shaped by the science and this is a sort of sequential approach that's intended to drive monitoring over a long period of time and provide answers on our regional trends. So the guiding questions were distilled into management questions that are more specific. And then from there, our technical advisory committee develops priority actions. So currently we have, five priority actions to be completed in the next 3 to 5 years of the WRMP. Each priority action will be used to develop monitoring metrics and protocols. And those are ultimately linked back to those guiding questions. And that's where we can really achieve more adaptive management through this monitoring program. So as the data is collected, we can circle back to those guiding questions and revise them over time as we address them. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Christina, who's going to discuss the priority actions in more detail.
Super. Thank you, Heidi. If we could go to the next slide, please. So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about the science priorities. And again, I really want to emphasize that this is a regional monitoring program to develop information for decision makers. This is not a regional research program. So each of these science priorities is grounded in answering a priority guiding question for the WRMP. So our first science priority is developing surveys and an inventory of the distribution, abundance, diversity, and condition of tidal wetlands. And this is a priority action in response to guiding question number one in the program plan, which is where are the region's tidal wetlands and wetland projects, and what net landscape changes in area and condition are occurring? So this is essentially where are the wetlands and how are they doing? And so to address this science priority, if you could go to the next slide, please. We're working with SFEI on the development of a new Balin's Change base map. And so this is a separately funded initiative that is funded by the EPA's Water Quality Improvement Fund. It's being developed by San Francisco Estuary Institute and supported by the WRMP TAC to develop a habitat map, and basically an update to the Bay Area Aquatic Resource Inventory, which is a data set that describes the distribution and abundance of habitats in the Baylands. So that includes tidal wetlands, intertidal mudflats, channels, ponds, pans, estuarine terrestrial transition zones, all of these different habitats, because we understand that really at a landscape scale, we need to understand the way that these habitats work together. This Baylands Change base map, our hope is that it will serve as the baseline against which future mapping efforts are compared to get a sense of this the science priority of understanding over time how the distribution and abundance of and condition of tidal wetlands are changing in the estuary. If we could go to the next slide, please. So this base map is not only going to present us with a sense of where these wetlands are and how they're doing, but it's going to establish some accessible standards for data collection and mapping at other projects, at individual projects throughout the estuary. It's going to help us assess the relationship between restoration projects and other tidal marshes throughout the estuary. It will help us assess their restoration evolution and their trajectory. And it'll help us support landscape scale adaptation to climate change, recognizing that we really don't want to take a postage stamp site-by-site approach to wetland restoration and climate change adaptation, but that we really need to think on a landscape scale. Next slide, please. Our second science priority is establishment of the WRMP's monitoring site network, including our benchmark sites. And this is in response to the priority recommended action based on guiding question two, which is how are external drivers such as accelerated sea level rise, development pressure, changes in runoff and sediment supply from watersheds, how are these factors, again, landscape scale factors, regional factors, impacting tidal wetlands? Next slide, please. The WRMP site network is comprised of three different types of sites, the first of which are these benchmark sites. The benchmark sites are the canaries in the coal mine. These are the mature, largely ancient marshes of which we don't have a lot left in the estuary. And they're largely in equilibrium with their governing physical and ecological processes. And so if we begin to see consistent signals of change in these marshes, it tells us something about how to contextualize the evolution and the observations that we're making at younger, less mature marshes, particularly restoration sites. The next type of sites are reference sites. These are still older, more mature marshes, but not necessarily ancient marshes, not necessarily millennial marshes. These could be centennial wetlands. These could be much older restoration sites. And these are sites that really serve as realistic endpoints for the evolution of restoration projects. It's highly unlikely, given how disturbed of a system we're operating in, and particularly due to climate change, that we can expect any of our restoration projects in the estuary to look like, for example, Petaluma Marsh, which would be an example of a benchmark site. But there are some older sites like Bull Island and in the Napa River, Outer Galenas Marsh. These are older centennial marshes that represent realistic evolution endpoints for restoration projects. And then there's the restoration projects themselves that reflect a variety of design and management approaches. Our goal is to ultimately, not initially, but ultimately at build out, establish a spatially relevant network of all of these different site types which within each subregion of the bay. So Sistoon, the North Bay, Central Bay, South Bay, Lower South Bay. And this is how we can begin to understand, really at scale, understand the way that the information that we're collecting at these different sites is related to each other. Next slide, please. Our third science priority is based on guiding question number 3, which is how do policies, programs, and projects to protect and restore tidal marshes affect the distribution, abundance, and health of plants and animals? And so our science priority is doing repeated surveys so that we can detect change in the populations and communities of living organisms and their habitats. Could you go to the next slide, please? And so a lot of this right now, what we're focused on doing within the TAC, within the Technical Advisory Committee, is really wrapping our arms around the existing monitoring programs in the estuary, of which there are many, to assess the diversity and the communities and the populations of target plant, fish, and wildlife species. And so one of the ways that we're tackling this right now is through a few different work groups. So we have some specialized work groups within the Technical Advisory Committee, one of which we're beginning to build out, which is focused on remote sensing and mapping and geospatial techniques. These are especially appropriate for monitoring vegetation communities at a landscape scale. But we also have a work group to crosswalk the many different efforts that are going on in the estuary, and potentially including the upper estuary and the delta, looking at fisheries and fish habitat. I want to give a shout out to our watershed stewardship program interns at Region 2. They're doing a tremendous job providing some targeted technical support to this effort, helping staff from CDFW, from NIMFS, from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, from UC Davis, helping everyone wrap their arms around the scale and the scope of historic fisheries and fish habitat monitoring in the estuary, and figuring out what previous data sets the WRMP can leverage and what future data collection activities we can implement to really fill the gaps and to really address these questions at a landscape scale. My suspicion is that the approach that we're taking with fisheries and fish habitat to really refine our indicators and our SOPs will likely be replicated with regards to birds and mammals, because there's similar challenges in terms of all of these kind of disparate monitoring programs that have been implemented for these species. So I expect that will have some future work groups to support the development of indicators related to birds and mammals. We're really looking at not reinventing the wheel. There's been a tremendous amount of effort already invested in monitoring communities and habitats in the estuary, and we want to build on that significant foundation so we can really understand what's happening at scale. Next slide. Our fourth science priority is based on guiding question number 4, which is what new information do we need to better understand regional lessons from tidal wetland restoration projects in the future? And a huge priority for the WRMP and a lot of other stakeholders in the program is analyzing the availability of sources of sediment to counter the threat of sea level rise. And I think do we have a follow-up slide? Yeah, we do. Sorry, if you could go to the follow-up slide. So This requires some really significant engagement between both the Wetland Regional Monitoring Program and the Bay Regional Monitoring Program Sediment Work Group. So the Bay RMP Sediment Work Group is largely focused on sediment supply and transport and conditions in the Bay. And what we're focused on in the WRMP is that sediment getting it to the marshes. How is sediment getting from watersheds, from the open bay into marshes? Is it driving accretion? What are the knobs and dials that we can turn to support landscape scale wetland resilience? So we're working very closely. The TAC is working very closely with the Bay RMP Sediment Work Group to identify priority locations for the establishment of benchmark sites. And again, those benchmark sites are the older marshes that are kind of our canaries in the coal mine. The Bay RMP is also funding some really crucial research on multiple factors related to estuary-wide sediment supply and transport, including new research with the U.S. Geological Survey with Jesse Lacey and Karen Thorne on tidally and wave-mediated sediment transport between marshes and mudflats. That project is beginning to get off the ground, and they're working very closely with the WRMP TAC to inform site selection and protocols and data interpretation and things like that. And you know, again, some of the indicators that the TAC has identified as a priority for establishing at these benchmark sites and at other types of sites throughout the site network, looking at suspended sediment, getting a better idea regionally, what is suspended sediment availability to accrete on our marshes and mudflats? Are marsh plains eroding? Are they accreting? Are they peeling back from the edge? Are our shorelines prograding into the bay? These are all priority indicators that we hope to get at through remote sensing and also direct measurement. Next slide, please. And our final science priority is based on guiding question 5. How do policies, programs, and projects to protect and restore tidal wetlands benefit and or impact public health, safety, and recreation? And so our science priority is monitoring the interactions between people and wetlands. And I'll be honest, this is something that we're not tackling very much in the TAC right now. We expect to tackle it in the near future. This encompasses a lot of things. This encompasses not only mosquito and vector control, but this encompasses recreation, flood control, shoreline protection, cross-jurisdictional climate change adaptation, community, engagement. How are communities engaging with their wetlands? How are they protected by their wetlands? There's a lot that comes into play. So we're still, to be frank, we're investing most of our effort right now in the previous 4 science priorities because they kind of build to this science priority. In order to understand the interactions between people and wetlands, for example, we need to have a basic understanding of where the wetlands are and how they're doing, which is science priority 1. So this is something that we want to tackle. We're just, we're not quite there yet. And I expect that we'll get to this later this year. Next slide, please. So I recognize that was a lot that you heard from both Heidi and myself. So we're excited to take your questions.
So do we have questions? I don't see any hands. I have to change the view to the gallery.
We do have one.
I've got some questions.
I bet. Go ahead, Andy.
Oh, this is so much fun. This harkens back to the creation of the regional monitoring program in the early 90s. So there are several things, and I look forward to kind of hearing more. This was a little bit of a drink out of a fire hydrant in a way, but a couple of things. I'm glad that you are collaborating with the RMP. I hope that you are finding opportunities to think through the RMP's success, what drove it, and that you are going to try and take those lessons. A couple of things that come to mind immediately for me. I was very glad you first talked about centralized data, and then you mentioned SFEI. SFEI is an incredibly unique institution that will be fundamental to the success of this program. And I'm sure I don't need to tell you that, but I need to say it, right? Okay. And the long-term funding is really going to be important. You're not going to be able to create this program using short-term funding because the objective, you're going to get yanked around. The specific objectives of the short-term funders will tend to drag you away, actually in time and in space, from the objectives that you need in order to hit these longer, address these long-term questions. And those long-term questions are the fundamentally important things. And I would love to see you develop it can be, I think, a very short, but transport me into 2040 and show me made up data, right? But show me the kind of things that you imagine us being, the regional board in 2040 being able to say and look at because this program exists. I think that will be really valuable. I didn't hear, maybe I didn't, Heidi, maybe I missed it, the mention of the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority as a source of long-term funding. But the authority has a distinct interest in demonstrating what they've done with all this money, both like on a 10-year time frame and a 20-year time frame. And I think that there's an overlap there, I would think, between your objectives and their objectives. That would allow them to be a part of this. The idea of the base map, of course, is fundamental to being able to show me this data in the future. That is, if you don't have, you know, if you're if methods migrate without calibration, of course, you're not going to be able to make effective assessments. However, I think that many of the people involved in this effort have been involved in monitoring wetlands in the estuary for a long time. And I think that I'm assuming you already have examples where we are hindcasting, right? We can look at projects, assessments done in the 70s and the 80s, the 90s, and they provide an example for us of how, if we can continue this forward on the scale of decades, we're going to be really in the driver's seat in terms of understanding what's happening in our region as sea level rise accelerates, you know, around mid-century. And so I really think that it's really important to give not just the questions that you're answering, but I would encourage you to demonstrate the kinds of data that you think you can create. And that could either be, like I said before, making it up just for illustrative purposes to show how the decision-making in the future will be enhanced. But also, I bet there are examples looking backwards where we have information that has allowed us to either, say, make decisions about large-scale restoration plans in the salt ponds, or how you approach, Christina, how you approach an individual project, understanding from past monitoring the kinds of things we need to do. I know that we've learned a lot, and it would be great to be able to show people that. I mean, I think that I'm glad to hear that you're not reinventing the wheel. You know, there's a lot there, but I also acknowledge that when you start reaching back into the past, you're dealing with projects that maybe didn't use quite the same methods, didn't use quite the same analytical procedures. So it's a challenge, but there is going to be an incredible need to show long-term trend data one way or the other. It's going to be fundamental for us understanding, as you said, what's happening and how well we're doing. I mean, I'm glad there were only five major questions, not 10, even the five, I'm glad to hear that you are prioritizing within that. I think that there are, we don't need to go into it now, but I looked at those five questions as you presented them, and there were definitely ones I thought would be the most important for us to have solid understanding of 20 years from now, as opposed to others, which might be beneficial, but don't quite rise to that same level of importance in terms of informing our decision making, where we're going to be spending enormous amounts of money in coming decades. And having a solid understanding of what we've done previously and how that has, the results that have come from those are going to be really essential. And I know you have a lot of that information in hand, but getting it organized and out there might mean that some of your other questions you can't quite get to in order to really hit the target with these key monitoring results. And I think that it's also important for my fellow board members to understand that this kind of monitoring might seem scientific. It is scientific, but it doesn't attract scientific partners because it's just repeating methods over and over again. It's really, really important. But as an academic, you don't get any kind of real accolades for this kind of work. And so it lives in this in-between space. And I think that it's great to see the level of organization, Heidi and Christina, that you guys have. I know this group has been working together for quite a long time to get to this point. And I think it's really essential. And I'm really glad that funding is right at the beginning here, because it's really hard to find. But the RMP has shown us that when you find it, you can do remarkable stuff that really informs our decision making and will make the job of my predecessor in this chair much more, they'll be able to be much more effective, much more confident about making important large scale decisions about restoration. So thanks for this. It's really great. And I'll look forward to hearing more about it as we go forward.
Great. I appreciate that you appreciate it. And if there are specific questions that we can answer about funding elements and what it might look like in 40 years and kind of visions for information feedback into decision-making, we're happy to tackle those.
Does anyone want to try to follow that?
I will just say thank you to Board Member Gunther. I was sure he would have something helpful to say. And I appreciate all the work. I have just a quick question. I am working with many other environmental organizations around the Bay, different work that they're doing. And I just wanted you to maybe, I'm in my brain, I'm sort of balancing the need for this long-term science that takes time and Michael Mann saying we have no time left. And so we have to be making decisions now, and land management agencies, conservation agencies are making decisions. And so I just wondered if you could talk for a minute about how will you share this work, and how can people access it to learn and to make decisions?
Sure. Do you want to tackle that, Christina, or would you like me to?
I think Heidi, you're involved with the SFEI on this, so why don't you tackle it?
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the question. Definitely. I think any way that we can move forward into, as I mentioned in the presentation, moving away from this model where monitoring data just sits on a shelf and really allows us to add more power and impact to the data that is being out there and being collected. So I think that part of the answer to the question is just having that data available to managers, to the water board, to other regulators, as well as to scientists, you know, in science institutions to do research as well, will hopefully allow that feedback loop to move a little bit more quickly between what's going out, what's happening in our wetlands, and how are we making management decisions. And as Christina laid out, our management questions are really intended to try to parse out, you know, what is causing these changes within our wetlands. Is it external drivers, you know, like land use or climate change? Is, you know, how can we learn from restoration design successes and also failures so that we can improve the way that we design wetlands in the future? So really trying to get at more of a nuanced understanding and a quicker, I think, response time between when we get the data and how we can respond to it through our management actions. Like I said, both at the level of, you know, climate change and these larger pressures, but also in terms of restoration design objectives and improving the way that we actually design wetlands to meet our objectives. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I mean, I guess if I could just make a comment is just that the communication and the outreach as you learn, even if it's not perfect, even if it's not all the way done, I mean, people are really hungry for the best information they can get to make the best decisions that they can.
Yeah, I'll just add a couple of things to what Heidi said is we're currently working with SFEI on a data management plan, and a key component of that is accessibility. So that, you know, what is the interface to make it more accessible? And then also Heidi has I'm in the middle of reviewing the draft charter, and a key component of that is incorporating community involvement into the steering committee, as well as developing an outreach plan so that we can get the information out.
Okay, I can't resist. One just last comment is don't forget those non-traditional partners who are all of a sudden paying a lot of attention to climate, from corporate property owners to conservation organizations to social justice organizations. It's big net.
I'm going to channel my grandson and say, awesome. This is very exciting. And to echo what board member Batty said, the ability to organize those non-traditional members who actually have an interest in this is the key to political success. You know, the strategic partnerships with entities like the East Bay Regional Park District. So I'm just so pleased to see this. If there's no more comments, my computer is, Andy's got one. Andy.
Do you guys anticipate that organizing this information by OLU is going to be a valuable way to deliver it to various parties?
You want me to tackle that, Javier? Yeah, so thanks for asking that, Andy. And so for anyone in the audience who may not be familiar, an OLU is an operational landscape unit, which is a kind of awkward label that we've given to segments of the Baylin landscape in the San Francisco Shoreline Adaptation Atlas, which was sponsored by the Water Board, developed by SFEI. Board Member Gunther was on our Management Advisory Committee during the development of the first phase of the Adaptation Atlas. We're currently developing the second phase of it. We feel that there's actually a lot of overlap between the Adaptation Atlas and the WRMP in terms of, you know, developing development and application of information. So certainly, you know, one of the key elements of the Adaptation Atlas and the entire OLU framework is we're trying to support cross-jurisdictional landscape planning. So we're trying to develop climate change adaptation strategies that cross traditional political jurisdictions and are effective at a landscape scale to support landscape scale resilience, to support, you know, have complete marshes that have functional physical and ecological connections to the open waters of the bay and to watersheds and to streams and to uplands. the WRMP is going to help us understand where the wetlands need help so that we can support that landscape scale resilience and protect both the natural and built community. In turn, the WRMP can also develop information to support modeling. For example, one of the things that we're looking at in the second phase of the Adaptation Atlas is where can we prioritize the establishment of complete marshes to support wildlife, to support the breeding and dispersion of, for example, clapper rails or salt marsh harvest mouse. And so by having a more regional framework for understanding how these organisms and their habitats are distributed and how they're related to each other, it can help us do a better job of planning projects to help support those communities. So there's a lot of examples like that. And that's why I'm really grateful that we have overlap between the TAC for the Adaptation Atlas and the WRMP, because there's a lot of examples of this, you know, where they're related. And so that's a longer version. That's a longer answer when the short version is yes.
Good. Okay. Because I've just been struck by, and I think the evidence is pretty clear, that the geography of the OLUs has resonated with people in a variety of communities. And they're creating a table that brings the right people together, and people want to be there talking about it. And the scale help, you're helping people understand that despite the fact that this wetland crosses a county boundary, it's one thing that we're all going to benefit from. And so I think that it's a great opportunity to follow up on Vice Chair Batty's question about integrating other people's comments, that I think that's a great, those people sitting around those tables will be great audiences and also provide valuable responses to the WRMP as it goes forward.
And crucially, I would add that, you know, the San Francisco Estuary Institute is putting the final touches on their Bayline assessment of sediment supply and demand to support landscape resilience. And that information in that report has actually been organized by OLU. So very shortly, we're going to have this assessment of which OLUs need more sediment to support resilience of the existing tidal marshes, as well as the future projected restoration projects, and where that sediment is actually available, you know, coming from the watersheds, which systems, you know, support that sediment load. So this is bringing in, you know, flood controlled districts, landowners, adjacent to flood control channels, you know, trying to figure out how to replumb our baylands. So this is another, you know, related effort that is utilizing OLUs that is relevant to the WRMP that is bringing in a large cross section of stakeholders.
Thank you.
I think that Jim.
I think our chairman just disappeared.
Yeah, Chair McGrath has fallen.
You went to lunch.
If there are no further questions, I would recommend we proceed to the next presentation. Is that okay with the board?
Yeah, thank you, Heidi and Christina. Could I entertain just like a quick bio break while we get the next speakers lined up, and then we could finish up our meeting? Yeah. But yeah. Like just go do what you need to do and come right back.
Great. Yeah. And thank you. Thank you again to our speakers. Excellent job. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, back in 2 minutes.
And you're live.
Thank you, members of the public and the interested parties. We're back in session, and we're to the last item on Bay Adapt. Michael, do you want to introduce this, or should we just go to Jessica?
Yeah, I'll just give a quick introduction. I want to thank our colleagues from BCDC for coming today and talking about Bay Adapt. Executive Director Larry Goldspan and I have been working very closely and very collaboratively since I began in this position. I really have appreciated that relationship, and we have made a significant investment in Bay Adapt. We see it as a an important process for us to be involved with and contributing to. I want to thank Lisa Horowitz McCann, Javier Fernandez, and the staff that we have that are participating in the work groups. Lisa's providing a lot of leadership on the leadership advisory group for this effort. And I want to welcome Dana Breckwald and Jessica Fay for coming today and presenting to the board on Bay Adapt. This is our premier, I would say, premier investment in terms of collaborative work in climate, in the climate space. And I hope you'll find it informative and a worthy choice for our investment. Thanks.
I'll echo that. The improved collaboration between BCDC and regional board is a really nice thing to have seen. Go ahead, Jessica.
Great, thank you. I believe there's a presentation. There it is. So hi, everyone. Good afternoon. And I hate to be the last thing between you and your lunch, but hopefully you'll find this interesting and we can have a little bit of time after my short presentation for some discussion. Again, I'm Jessica Fain. I'm the planning director at BCDC. And as you can see, I'm joined today by Larry Goldspan, our executive director, and Dana Breckwald, who is the program manager of our Adapting the Rising Tides program, who will be available to answer any questions during our Q&A portion. So I'm just gonna go through a short overview of what Bay Adapt is and what it's trying to achieve and sort of where we're at this point. In short, Bay Adapt is the goal is a regional initiative to develop a consensus-driven strategy to address a rising bay. So next slide. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. You all know that sea level rise is happening in the Bay Area. Next slide. We know, so what will the consequences of this be? We know based on a lot of existing projects and information that we have out there that no matter where you live in the Bay Area, the shoreline flooding will impact everyone. Here are just some stats from our recently completed Adapting to Rising Tides Bay Area study that we completed about a year ago that looked comprehensively across the Bay at our interconnected risks and systems across our infrastructure and transportation network, our housing and jobs locations. Oh, sorry, next. Yep, keep clicking. And our socially vulnerable residents and our ecosystems, particularly our wetlands, lagoons, and tidal marshes. Next slide. We also know that it requires regional solutions. There's a lot going on at the local level in terms of adapting to sea level rise, but the premise of this is that it's not enough. And why, as you well know, flooding knows no boundaries. The Adaptation Atlas and other reports have clearly demonstrated and kind of focus on this challenge. We know that frontline communities are the ones that are most impacted with the fewest resources. We have a patchwork of protective actions that aren't communicating always with each other. There's inconsistent application of science. There's competition and not collaboration for limited funds. The near-term loss of wetlands as our ecosystems on the front line, an issue I know that's very close to the water board. And there's no way to really measure our collective progress. And it was interesting to hear the previous presentation on the regional monitoring program to see kind of some of the connections here. Next slide. So what are the solutions? This is where Bay Adapt really is trying to come in. Next slide. The good news is, we're not starting from scratch in the Bay Area. We have a really great foundation for action. And so a big premise of Bay Adapt is to not recreate, but to build on all of these great initiatives and research and science and projects that are already underway. And these include a variety of things that are happening in the climate science and services realm to two major research and kind of foundational science, like the Adaptation Atlas, the Baylin's Goals, and other things like that. So next slide. BayAdapt is really trying to weave all of this together and bring it up to the level of, well, what are the top actions then that we need to take as a region? And so here's our mission. To BayAdapt is to develop a regional consensus-driven strategy that lays out the actions necessary to adapt the Bay Area to rising sea level and to protect people and the natural and built environment. So really, what are these top 10 to 15 priority actions that we as a region need to take to make sure we're really setting ourselves up for dealing with this problem in the long term? Next slide. So what we did was start with the people. We really didn't want this to be a BCDC plan, but really what a consensus-driven strategy. And so the first thing we did was establish a leadership advisory group. And if you could just click, here are the members of this leadership advisory group. As you can see, it's about 30 executive level leaders from a range of different NGOs, agencies at different levels, who all have kind of a role to play in sea level rise adaptation. And that group has been meeting regularly over the last year and a half or so. And just a special thanks to Mike Montgomery and Lisa Horowitz-McCann for representing the Water Board on this group. We also have been hosting, engaging the public. So we hosted a public forum nearly a year ago at this point, and we plan on hosting another one of those shortly. We've also convened working groups. This is really the powerhouse of how we've developed these actions. Over the summer, over 100 stakeholders from different organizations came together and really helped come up with a draft of these initial actions. And then we've also been doing community and elected official outreach, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Next slide. The first thing that the leadership group did was establish a set of guiding, oh, I'm sorry, go back one. Okay. Maybe my presentation looks a little different than yours. if you could go back to the one, is there a guiding principles one? Back. There we go. Okay. Thank you. Not used to not controlling my own slides. So the first thing we did was establish a set of guiding principles. These guiding principles are sort of the North Star for this whole initiative, and they include things like practicing inclusive community-led governance and decision-making, centering and supporting socially vulnerable communities, going green where appropriate, importantly, not holding back early movers, but also thinking sufficiently long-term. And, you know, also recognizing that not all places or pathways are the same. We live in a diverse Bay Area geographically, and you know, communities are different. And so there's not kind of one size fits all approach. Next slide. And so ultimately, you know, this is kind of like the machine and how this thing gets made. You know, all of this input has led us to thinking about all the different kind of really comprehensive look at all the barriers, concerns, and solutions to these main challenges, summing them up in a series of actions. And then these actions together are what we're calling the joint platform. And at this point, we have in the fall put together a first draft of what this joint platform will look like. So if you go to the next slide, I'm just going to talk quickly through some of these high-level actions. Each one of these has several pages of a description of the kind of who, what, when, why, and how of how this action would be implemented. But I'll just, for the purposes of today, give you the high level. So there's the first set of actions are around this idea of kind of a vision. So action one is around coming up with a regional vision. What does our Bay look like in the future? And a consistency framework to help move people in the right direction and in the same direction to achieve this vision. It also includes an action on the creation of a collaborative management structure to achieve achieve all the goals and actions in the joint platform. Click. The next actions are really around engagement and environment, particularly with a focus on frontline communities and environmental justice. So action three is around community leadership and capacity building, starting with this an idea of a funded role for a consortium of regional community-based organizations who can really help guide regional adaptation. That doesn't kind of exist today. Action four is around focusing on education with current and future climate leaders and youth, but really around two-way education between communities, government, and young people. Click. Most of the actions fall into this next category of alignment between local and regional action. How do we kind of coordinate what's happening locally and what's happening regionally? And so these include actions on things like local planning, measuring progress, state planning requirements, and ensuring that there's alignment between what cities are required to do and making sure they really are giving us what we need, permitting and permitting coordination, and regulatory and policy innovation. And then finally, there are several buckets that are related to funding and legislation. This is a big topic. One idea is the creation of a regional adaptation funding plan, as well as a regional legislative working group to better organize the region legislatively around this topic. Data and science is around an idea of a climate services consortium or climate services for the Bay specifically, as well as improved resources at kind of a one-stop shop approach. And then finally, there's actions that are more specifically around project implementation. One of them is this idea of the creation of landscape scale stakeholder groups around the OLU level. How do we kind of create that community of practice at the scale of the operational landscape unit so that projects can really happen at that scale as well? And then finally, under Action 15, there's a variety of different ways of improving construction and logistics for this type of work that happens at the water-land interface. So that's an overview of where the actions are now, or as of the fall. Over the past several months, we've entered into what we're calling a refine and discuss phase. We presented these actions to our leadership advisory group in the fall. And while they were appreciative of, I think, all the hard work and energy and the fact that we have kind of a draft, they did feel and direct us that they would like to see one, more outreach to communities and stakeholders around kind of how they see these actions. And also just another path. We developed it fairly fast. And so how can we kind of refine them to really make them shine and speak to different audiences? So that's the phase that we're in right now. Dana and I have probably given over 50 kind of high level presentations around this work around the region. So we've been doing a lot of kind of general outreach. But we've also been doing a series of focus groups. And I just want to, again, thank the Water Board for your partnership on this. We've hosted, I think it's about 8 different focus groups, several with frontline communities in East Palo Alto and Vallejo, several with elected official and local government folks from around the Bay. We've also hosted one with the civic and business community, and then one with an environmental community. And those have been extremely informative. We've also been working with a joint platform subcommittee, members of the leadership group who are just helping us kind of massage and think through this material. And so all of this is adding up to the creation of, you know, joint platform draft 2.0, which we're in the process of really developing right now. Our next steps will be to bring the leadership group together, hopefully in April, to look at the second draft, see what they get their feedback on it. And then embark with a more broad outreach phase where we will host a public forum, open it up for public comment, do some more direct outreach, and then hopefully the leadership group will be able to adopt and implement it this summer. So last slide is just the website. If you wanna stay abreast, www.bayadapt.org, you can sign up for our newsletter there if you're not already on it, and that's where we post things as they come out. So I'll end there, and I'm happy to discuss more and answer any questions.
Questions from the board? Andy, go ahead.
Thanks, Jim. So Jessica, that's it's great. I just wanted to say a couple of things. One, I've seen you talk about BidApt several times. The story is getting better. Okay. And your presentation is really, I'm really just want to thank you. It takes work to kind of do that. And I know you guys have, I don't know how many times you've given that, talked about BidApt to various places. But it's getting better. And I also wanted to say, I understand that there was many people really wanted you to update and refine and come back with a 2.0 version. I want to congratulate you on that. It is not an indication that there was anything wrong. It's that people are really paying attention to you and paying attention to this program. And I think that this idea of a platform of 15 things is going to be very, very valuable. And I want you to continue to persevere, despite the fact that I know some people had some criticisms of what you came out with before. Don't be discouraged. I think that it's really an important effort that you are participating in. It's really great to see it evolve. And I'm really looking forward to reading version 2.0 in detail.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Other comments?
Jim, I'll jump in. Alexis, you go ahead first. Go ahead. No? Okay. I just want to thank you all for all the great work. It's really exciting to see how much has happened over the last couple of years and to see all this come together. I love how far-reaching the collaborative effort has been. I want to ask a question, and I'm not sure if I'm even going to get it right, but I'm wondering, as you look at this plan, what part of it is the most daunting when you think about getting to the path from where we are now to implementation? What part is the most daunting and you think will be the biggest challenge to overcome?
I'll give you two, and I'm curious what Dana and Larry might think. To me, the two most sensitive, I guess, areas are a carrot versus a stick approach. There's lots of discussion about that. I don't know if we're going to get there substantially with this. We might, but that always comes up is, you know, can we solve this problem through an incentive-based approach, or do we need more regulation? And I think the answer is probably maybe a mix of those, but I don't think, anyways, it's an area that comes up a lot, and then, you know, we'll see how far we can get in this effort. And the second one, I would say, quite frankly, is our environmental justice and community engagement side of things. It's a critical part of this initiative and to regional adaptation to bring communities and frontline communities into the center and have a real leadership role. But that represents a pretty fundamental shift in the way of doing business. And so I think that's another big kind of challenging area. How we do that.
Thank you. Larry or Dana, do you want to add to that at all?
I'll let Dana go first.
I think one of them is similar. I think just getting the right roles for the right people and having people figure that out and be okay with the roles that other people are playing and orchestrating that to, you know, add up to something beautiful. And then the other thing is funding. And I don't just mean, you know, paying for projects, but we have so many, somebody once asked me how much it would cost to do everything in the joint platform. And I think I said, I can't remember what I said, but it was several $1 million, and their jaw just fell on the ground. And, you know, we just have a lot of work to do aside from just projects. So I think, you know, getting the resources we need to actually do all of the work is going to be a challenge.
Thanks.
I'm going to say there's one more big challenge that you all, I think, face just like we do. And that is the tension between local control and regionalism. And it's not just the idea of governance. It's the idea of governance with regard to, you know, state, local, federal. It's the idea of being in control of your own destiny versus being part of a regional destiny. And I think the rubber's really going to hit the road in spring and summer when the members of the leadership group and the folks who've been working with us, and there have been, I don't know, Jessica, at least 100, right, outside the leadership group who've been working with us, actually have to make some choices about whether they're going to cede some of their destiny to something larger than they are, or whether they're going to pull back and not do that. And, you know, we're not advocating here for some now new large bureaucracy to do stuff. We're advocating here for a collaborative process among everyone, because we're all interested stakeholders. And so the question really is going to be whether members of the leadership group and members outside who've been helping us are going to be willing to, you know, go from gripping really tightly to letting go a little bit and knowing that they're not going to agree with everything. But are they going to be willing to move forward with that with which they don't necessarily agree, knowing that this is a long-term process?
I don't remember back to your list right now, but ABAG, MTC, are they part of this conversation? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's an opportunity there, too. There's another process with their plan, Bay Area 2040, 50? What is it? 40.
50.
Where there may be more opportunity to integrate the work you're doing with that. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate the work.
Yeah, very interesting.
Alexis?
The presentation's a question for Larry. Given how closely the board and BCDC work together on dredging, do you see any opportunities, or maybe Xavier as well, see any opportunities this year in the Corps' dredging program or other smaller projects, perhaps, for us to advance some of the larger goals we have?
We had, it was so interesting that you bring that up, because we actually had a discussion about that among a few of us yesterday. I think that there is a tremendous opportunity for the Bay Area as a whole within the Washington, D.C. nascent effort on infrastructure. You know, like you all, I read the newspapers and still have no clue what's going on in Washington. Of course, the people who write the newspapers probably have maybe just a little bit more of a clue, but nobody really knows what's next, you know, after the $1.9 trillion and what does infrastructure mean and the like. But we have already started talking with our friends at the Coastal Conservancy and the like about what opportunities could exist in an infrastructure bill that could change the way the Corps does business, for example. You know, here's a question. You know, is there a way that all navigation projects, dredge material, should go right to beneficial reuse? Boom, done. You know, and how much of the problem would that actually solve? How much would it actually cost with regard to the marginal increment that it would cost to do that? Could that be part of an infrastructure process? You know, it's those kinds I think there's the opportunity right there with regard to how dredging, for example, works. It's just an idea. And don't worry, Mike doesn't get out of it. I mean, just because, and Mike, you and I talked about this on Friday, I think, a little bit, when, you know, during one of our semi-regular Friday afternoon at 4:30. Let's pick up the phone and talk to each other and try to make it through the rest of the week kind of calls. You know, we talked to some extent about this kind of idea.
So in the short term for this year, something came up in our last LTMS Executive Management Committee, and I actually just got an email today about it. But Montezuma has pushed the Corps into allowing for the Port of Oakland's dredging a value engineering assessment after they get their bids. So the entire Port of Oakland dredging was going to go to deep ocean disposal, which we really have no control over because it's outside of waters of the state. When we look at it, the incremental cost of deep ocean relative to beneficial reuse is marginal at best. The incremental cost between in-bay disposal and beneficial reuse is more significant. But if we allow a little more in-bay disposal, let's say I'm just going to throw a fictitious number out because we haven't looked at this. But if we say, okay, you can dispose of 20% of the Port of Oakland's dredging in bay if you send the rest of it to beneficial reuse, then that marginal cost difference will tip in favor of beneficial reuse. And, you know, we have language in our permit that allows the Corps to actually exceed their in-bay disposal thresholds if they take the excess material or a certain amount of material, I think it's equal, but it could be greater, to beneficial reuse. So we're set up to push for that now. And thankfully we had folks from the outside push for us, since deep ocean disposal is not really something we have a lot of control over. And that's about, we're talking about 900,000 cubic yards of material. So, you know, around a million, you figure, you know, 80% in the range of 700 and something thousand, even 50% is 450,000 cubic yards is very significant.
I certainly think this is savvy. I thought it was a pretty smart thing to do the first time I saw it done many years ago. And one of the other arguments that you can certainly craft, and something I remember from my days working for the Port of Oakland, is that the harbor maintenance tax has enough money to do a lot more beneficial reuse. It's just not spent. And that's an argument that I think, there's a fundamental fairness argument there, that if the shippers are paying for the dredging of the harbors that provide their way of doing business, taking that money somewhere else rather than using it for long-term sustainability is not really very fair. I mean, I think a first grader can understand the fairness question there. So good luck on that. And I appreciate all you've been doing. Other questions, comments? It's been my pleasure to work with Jessica on trying to get some of Xavier's ideas of sustainability moving forward. We have to do our work early. So these strategic partnerships and with other agencies and with the public are how we're going to go forward. Thanks for coming. Any other
Jim,
final comments?
Jim, I do have a hand up.
I see it. Lisa.
Thank you. I just wanted to acknowledge, first of all, BCDC staff for all the time, brilliance, headaches, listening and adapting. Their investment in both facilitating this effort and technically guiding it is huge and probably unprecedented. And I really appreciate it. And it's really been an honor to watch that. And also to say that we should acknowledge that huge long list of participants and executive level staff and many of their staff participating on the work groups is a huge investment of organizations and partners in the Bay, which really does demonstrate, I think it was Board Member Gunther who mentioned specifically that people are noticing and people care. And I'm very optimistic that we can keep everybody at the table and adopt a platform. And hopefully that will then bring the same level of commitment to actually implement it. So thank you, Jessica and Dana and Larry, very much.
All right, Michael, we have no closed session, no further business. Any closing comments, or should we ask for a motion to adjourn?
I think we're ready to adjourn. Thank you.
Can I have a motion to adjourn?
Oh, just a quick question, Chair McGrath.
Go ahead.
Typically, before we close, could our executive officer give us a preview of the next month's agenda?
Yeah, thank you. Let's see. We have an NPDES permit coming. I believe it's Upper Napa Town. I'm sorry. Not Calistoga. Below Calistoga. Above St. Helena. Thank you. And then we also have the stream maintenance program for Sonoma, I believe. And we will have informational item on the CCMP, another important effort that we are dedicating some staff time to. I believe that's it.
Mike, just give me that acronym again, the CCMP.
It's basically the Bayland plan for the National Estuary Program.
Okay, thank you. All right, now I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Can I get a second?
I'll second.
Second.
All in favor?
All right.
Have a good weekend.
See you next month if I don't see you before.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all.